Burn It Down from Linkin Park, our brand new number one song. That's it for us this week. If you miss any part of the chart, get caught up at the SideshowCountdown.com.
And listen to us no matter where you are using the free iHeartRadio app.
I'm Nikki Sixx.
And I'm Carrie Kasem.
See ya.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Welcome, everybody. Why do you look like the cat who swallowed the canary?
Hi, Peter.
Hey, Jolene.
How's it going?
It's going good.
Good.
And welcome to all of you as well, each and every one, which is kind of a redundant thing, but it serves the purpose of welcoming all of you, but also is a single invitation for you to call our phone and talk number, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
If you'd like to email us anytime during the show, make your opinions known that way. Because this is an opinion show. We get a couple hours every week to let our freak flag fly.
Yes, and we do. Every week.
You know, that's what song is that from?
You know, I don't know, but I do like that saying a lot.
Some classic rock thing.
Yeah.
I think maybe
we're bad DJs.
Jimi Hendrix, I'd say.
Okay. Well, you know what?
And okay.
Someone will tell us because
email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short opinions may possibly be read on the air. Longer ones I'll try to look at in the next few months. I get these emails and I go, okay, oh, let me read this one. Wow, that's pretty interesting. When was it sent? Oh, March 3rd.
You're pretty good about it, really.
Give
yourself more credit.
I always get back to them.
Yes.
We'd like you to join us on Facebook. Hasn't been a lot of activity recently. It kind of ebbs and flows. Partly it depends on
summer.
Yeah,
you know, people aren't on their computers as much.
Yeah, well, I mean, we haven't been putting as much in either.
I'm guilty.
No. I mean, everybody that wants to utilize it can utilize it.
Yes.
Yeah. So
I'm
you can
all
go
alone.
Facebook.com/nightcall. We like likes, so give us a like. And the whole team Night Call is in place.
Are here, all of us.
Athena.
And Sarah.
Sarah.
Yes.
Everybody. We're all here, so we're ready to go. Get your calls. And some people, wow, have already called in. I wonder what they're going to talk about.
Curious. People are chomping.
Let's see. They're what?
Chomping at the bit.
Oh, chomping.
Chomping. What did you think I said?
Chomping.
No.
All right.
Not yet.
Yeah. What was it? It used to be, when was it, the 80s or something?
I don't really remember the 80s, but go ahead.
Yeah. But there was this comic, a guy from the Soviet Union. And we used to say, what a country.
Oh, yes, Yakhnov Smirnov or something like that.
Yakhnov Smirnov, yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, this is so distressing. This, everybody, I'm going to comment on this. Everybody, I think, knows that Jerry Sandusky, who was the former Penn State assistant football coach, convicted Friday of sexually abusing, a lot of kids, at least 10.
At least 10.
45 guilty verdicts out of 48 counts, which include rape and sodomy. They carry significant prison terms, and Sandusky will likely spend the rest of his life behind bars. He was taken into custody immediately. He's not going to be sentenced for 3 months. And it says here in this article in the New York Times, the case against Sandusky, even before his trial, had exacted an enormous toll.
Like
the kids.
Think about the toll on the kids and the families, the
parents.
They
don't mention it,
How do you even manage that information?
Joe Paterno, the university's famed head coach, had been alerted to at least one of Sandusky's attacks on a boy, was fired, went into a kind of exile, and was dead of cancer within months. I mean, that was incredible. Talk about mind-body connections.
Right,
huh?
Absolutely.
The university's longtime president, Graham B. Spanier, was dismissed as well, and Penn State officials, alumni, and students were forced to confront the possibility that the interests of big-time college sports had trumped concern for the welfare of vulnerable children. And Sandusky was taking these kids into this program. It was meant for underprivileged kids. And a very similar, similar in a sense, Monsignor William J. Lynn, a former cardinal's aide, was found guilty on Friday, same day, of endangering children, becoming the first senior official of the Roman Catholic Church in the United States convicted of covering up sexual abuses by priests under his supervision.
I was actually taken back by that information right there, because how many are there, really?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I guess there have been so many cases with the priests that the focus has been on that, perhaps. And
instead
now
of this massive cover-up.
Yeah, and they're going to the other layers of the abuse.
He was acquitted of conspiracy, Monsignor Lynn was, and a bunch of other stuff. The single guilty verdict was widely seen as a victory for the district attorney's office. Monsignor Lynn sat impassively as the jury foreman announced the verdicts, but relatives behind him were in tears. Judge M. Teresa Cermina of the Common Pleas Court revoked his bail. The Monsignor stood up, removed his clerical jacket, and was led by sheriff's deputies to a holding cell area. Well, as I said, I think most people were aware of this to some degree or another. Certainly the Sandusky case.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think people are so immune to this Catholic Church abuse that all these stories kind of meld into one, don't you think?
Yeah, but you know what, to me, and comments on it at 313-298-WRIF, is that well, I don't know, maybe even two generations ago. If you count generations as 30 years, 60 years ago. So that, can you do some math for me? Let me see. What would that be?
50, I never do math on the air.
1952? Yeah, 1952. The amount of respect garnered by the dominant institutions of this society was unassailable. Everybody from corporate CEOs to priests, from from sports figures, certainly, to politicians. Politicians were highly thought of and highly respected.
Not so much anymore, right.
So, I mean, I wonder, particularly people that are coming up now, you know, people in their teens and their 20s, with no, you can't say anybody, well, here, just look at Father So-and-so or President So-and-so or something like that.
They're great examples.
Yeah. Where's the role models? I mean,
it's got to be the parents, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. Maybe, and that makes more sense. I mean, there was, I mean, think about the kind of trouble that President Clinton got in. Whereas he had one small dalliance that didn't even, as I remember, didn't even result in penetration, did it? At least of the... All right.
That type.
Yeah, that's it.
Right.
But here, President Kennedy...
Well, that wasn't one small...
Kennedy, they just kept it quiet.
Yeah, Kennedy had lots of babes, didn't he?
At the White House.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, there's Marilyn Monroe. Wow.
Well, I mean, maybe was it the era or...
Yeah, well, it was. I mean, to some ways, it was the big fraud. I mean, all these... I mean, if you imagine... Remember, we were talking last week about the Legionnaires of Christ, this run begun by this Mexican priest, and he had found out that he had abused all these boys. He had fathered children.
They found out.
Okay. Yeah.
He didn't find out. He done did it.
Oh, my God. I didn't realize that. Yeah, they found... You know, it came to light that he'd... that he'd abused boys, that he'd fathered children, and then his American counterpart, the same thing. So all that while, this Legionnaires of Christ, for instance, was giving these lectures on propriety and sexual abstinence and
of
all
course.
That. And you look at the politician, same thing, or anybody. You know who was really well respected 50, 60 years ago?
Who?
Bankers!
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, bankers,
that's
man.
That's gone, too.
They were even perhaps more so than, I don't know, right
up
to the top.
You're right, because back then, when you went to the bank, you put on your Sunday best.
Right.
That's how you went to the bank, and now I'm going in my pajamas.
That's right. That's right. Well, and CEOs, chief executive officers. I was reading this article today in the New York Times, and you read it too, Jalene. Mm-hmm. By the way, anytime you want to hook in, 313-298-WRIF. An article in today's New York Times, Apple's retail army, long on loyalty, short on pay.
Yeah.
Last year, during his best three-month stretch, Jordan Goldson sold about $750,000 worth of computers and gadgets, and he did so at the Apple store in Salem, New Hampshire. He was earning $11.25 an hour. Part of me was thinking, he said, this is great. I'm an Apple fan. The store is really doing well. But when you look at the amount of money the company is making, then you look at your paycheck, he says, it's kind of tough.
Yeah, that's tough to swallow.
What does that mean? That comes out to be about $23,000 a year.
Okay.
Yeah. And according to the U.S. government figures, a family of four, if they're making that much, they're not living in poverty. It's like around $2,000 or $20,000. I'm bad. I just went blah because the mouth isn't working well.
Family
yeah.
of four under $20,000.
It's
that's
insane.
That's what's considered poverty.
No family could live on
$22,000. No.
That's ridiculous.
No, without plenty of assistance or a really good family.
Yeah. America's love affair with the smartphone has helped create tens of thousands of jobs at places like Best Buy and Verizon Wireless, and it's going to pump billions into the economy. Well, not from these folks, because that's part of the problem. That's one of the things I want to talk about. Within this world, the Times says, the Apple Store is the undisputed king, a retail phenomenon renowned for impeccable design, deft service, and spectacular revenues. Last year, the company's 327 global stores took in more money per square foot than any other United States retailer, wireless or otherwise, and almost double that of Tiffany, which was number two on the list, according to Research Retail Sales. Worldwide, they sold $16 billion in merchandise, but it says most of Apple's employees enjoyed little of that wealth. While consumers tend to think of Apple's headquarters in Cupertino, California, as the company's heart and soul, a majority of its workers in the United States are not engineers or executives with hefty salaries and bonuses, but rather hourly wage earners selling iPhones and MacBooks. And that says nothing of the overseas employees. Something, what is it, 8% of Apple's production is done here in the United States.
I know. Yeah, and I've read a lot of horror stories about their production.
You know, in China.
Yeah, in China. Yeah. And I imagine that these employees also have a cap on how much they can work, so they don't get benefits, a lot of them.
Actually, that is the one thing there. I was surprised.
Did you get them?
Yeah, Apple offers above average pay.
Above average pay?
Better for stores like that, for retailing. Better than the Gap, though, slightly less than Lululemon. What the hell is Lululemon?
I don't know.
The yoga and athletic apparel chain.
Oh.
But anyway,
I should know that.
The Apple stores pay about $12 an hour. The company also offers very good benefits for retail, including health care, 401k contributions, and the chance to buy company stock as well as Apple products at a discount. The average employee brought in $473,000 per employee.
That is amazing.
Okay. Even Apple, though, it says, has decided needs to pay its workers more. Last week, 4 months after the New York Times first began inquiring about the wages of its store employees, the company started to inform some staff members that they would receive substantial wages. All right. So, I mean, this is kind of par for the course. I suspect, just from some of the photographs in that article, it's mostly younger people, 35 and under, a lot of people saying, hey, it's a job, it's a step up, it's
right,
a big company.
Especially in this economy.
You know, can you imagine just meeting somebody and they say to you, where do you work? And you say, oh, I work for Apple. People go, wow, man.
Ooh.
Yeah. Here's what it winds up to be, though. Boy, I couldn't send you this. You see all this teeny weeny little print on two full pages in the New York Times?
Sure.
This is the executive pay for the top 200 chief executives for large public companies.
They do this every year, don't they?
Did they? They may. But here's the deal. This does not include privately held firms.
Okay.
So all the hedge funds.
So imagine what they're making.
All the hedge funds and all that. Yeah. Let's see. The average pay for the top 200 was $20 million a year with all the compensation. You know,
average pay.
Yeah.
Okay.
$20 million.
Wow.
Yeah. And now with Steve Jobs gone, Timothy D. Cook, who is now the CEO of Apple, you're not going to believe this. His total compensation for last year was $378 million.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
$378 million. Yeah. I wonder
And how about all the people who are going to say, well, he earned that money.
He earned that. Well, here's the deal.
What is it about the people who are starving in this country?
One of the reasons that he was able to make that, and one of the reasons that Apple is so profitable, is that it pays slave labor wages in China.
Overseas.
Yeah.
Correct.
I mean, it could have I was thinking about that if, that article? They were talking about how many employees are here. There is 43,000 Apple employees in this country. Many of them earn about $25,000 a year, and 30,000 of them work in the Apple stores. So I was thinking, taking the number 40,000, if they doubled their pay to 50,000 a year, that would cost Apple $1 billion. I mean, that's not much.
They could afford it.
Yeah, easily.
Yeah.
And in fact, they could bring everybody back from overseas. I mean, Put the jobs here. They would make substantially less because they would have to pay people
more money here.
Yeah. Good wages.
Yeah.
Things that
fair living wages.
Yeah, that people in the United States have actually not only fought for but died for. And yet, this company, which enjoys, although it's been kind of fraying over the last months with all this stuff about their China production and the suicides at their at that plant in China and what have you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what it would mean, but let's just stick with these guys. I mean, remember, the reason they're over there is because they don't even want to pay employees $25,000 a year. Because if Apple opened plants all around the country to supply iPhones and iBooks and what have you, and said, hey, listen, we're coming back to the U.S. and we can only pay $25,000, but come on down to this this recruitment center in Tennessee or Wyoming or Michigan or something like that, they'd have a line 5,000 deep for these $25,000.
Yeah. Got that right.
Yeah, $12.50 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, yeah, and I don't know. I mean, there hasn't been much made of this. The fact that actually, his base salary, Timothy D. Cook, the CEO of Apple, his base salary is $900,000.
My God.
But with all the cash bonuses, his perks, his stock awards, option, well, didn't get any option awards, $378 million. Next, of course, everybody's heard of this man, the second, who makes $137 million a year. David Simon, we all know him, right, from the Simon Property Group.
And
I
we
never,
do?
No, I never heard.
Okay.
Number four is Lawrence J. Ellison, who always is up there. He's Oracle, $77 million. And we mentioned him last week, Leslie Moonves.
Oh, yeah, of CBS.
Of CBS, taking home $68 million. I mean, I don't understand why there's not
TV. There's money in reality TV.
Why there's not, like, stockholder revolt saying, how about giving him $8 million, you know, and distributing the other $60 million?
Well, it just kind of goes with everything else in this country. Where are the revolts? Where is the revolution?
Wow. What a great lead-in.
Really?
Yeah.
See, this is why we're together,
Peter. We're a team. This in the Detroit News. Wow. Peter actually reads Detroit papers?
Once in a while.
Once in a while, yeah. Michigan State University budget hikes tuition 3.5. CMU, Central Michigan, up. What's SVSU? So Saginaw Valley State University.
Yeah.
Eastern Michigan up 4%. MTU. I don't know what that is. Mid-Tech U. I don't know. University of Michigan, 3%. Dearborn, almost 4%. University of Michigan at Flint, 3.5%. MSU, yeah. Ferris, 3%. Wayne State, to be decided Wednesday. You know, folks, well, here, wait, in this article, where does it say? The current rate for freshmen and sophomores is $406 per credit hour, and juniors and seniors pay $440 and 50 cents per credit hour.
Outrageous.
It's out of control.
It really is.
So you're going to have more average middle class people and working class people, students, going into HOC. And, you know, who's loaning the money? Rich people, right? I mean, that's essentially.
Yeah, and then holding them by the cojones.
Yeah.
And for the rest of their lives.
Well, as I may have said from time to time over the last couple of weeks, in Quebec, in the province of Quebec, to the north of us. Mm-hmm. To the east of Ontario, there lies a province called Quebec.
Okay.
Yeah. And in it, there is a revolt going on of such intense proportions that I can't believe it's not the lead story on every single television newscast.
Yeah. Well, it's typical American media.
And it's about student tuition. They announced, the Liberal government of Quebec announced they were going to raise tuition. I forgot what the percentage was, but it was less than all this. And there has been a revolt of incredible proportions of the type, not quite reaching like Arab Spring, but for it in some of the countries. Hundreds of thousands of people out in the streets.
Yeah, the images are amazing.
Yeah. Every night at 8 o'clock, citizens go out and open their windows and beat on pots and pans and creating this.
Oh, man. I love that.
This din.
And it's too bad they have to. And that's what's amazing. In Canada, they're doing that when they're raising the tuition by less, and no one's even saying anything here.
Yeah. And
but us.
Well, and one of the things that, of course, that happens, we've talked about this before, when there's been student protests, for instance, in England, these people are already organized. When they talk about a student union, we usually think about the building. You know,
we'll
meet you at the student union at Wayne State.
Beer.
Yeah, right. Now they serve beer there. Before, they used to kick you out of school if you had it, but now... they sell it.
Times have changed.
Yeah, but they're already organized. That's it. They have student unions that address they're actually unions of students, and they address the issues that affect students. And now, I mean, because like any of you who are listening who are students are thinking, yeah, I'm screwed again. You know, I'm all by myself. And right. I mean, same thing if you're
you do feel helpless.
Helpless. Yeah. And that's what's encouraged by the dominant institutions that we were saying early garner no respect and appear to almost everybody to be a racket and hypocritical. So it's up to us to reinvent life. People are doing it in small versions in different projects around the country and in our city as well. But they're not, I mean, like Occupy, the big, huge Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's still there. It's kind of underneath the radar now. You don't have the big encampments or anything like that. But it put the idea of the 1% and us being the 99% on the map. That brought it above the radar.
Right.
So we started thinking.
To the mainstream media.
Yeah. That there is a Timothy D. Cook who is just wealthy beyond belief, who in 1 year makes $378 million by paying his employees the grand sum in this country of $25,000, and probably, I doubt if it's one-fifth, 20% of that in China.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how do we rectify it? Well, you know, actually in China, to the great consternation of the government, the workers are beginning to organize into unions. So it's like
I wonder if it'll be the violence like it happens, you know, people getting shot.
It is. But it's like it's like the 1880s or the 1890s. It was the way that, for instance, the Republicans are trying to drive us back to, without any union protection, without any legal protections, because there was only one point, maybe between like 1935 and 1975, where we created a middle class, where we figured as a middle of, rather as a matter of right, that we deserved a middle class income. So the people that didn't, for instance, let's start with the working class below it, had organized to say, hey, look, you know, we're not doctors, we're not store managers, we're not owners of small businesses, but we're key to the economy, and we put nuts.
We deserve everything.
We deserve a middle class.
Yep.
We deserve middle class, and boom, you know, a lot of it went up. The poor said, well, wait a minute, everybody can't get into the middle class. It's absolutely financially and socially impossible. So we're going to have a big safety net. We're going to have a safety net for our seniors. We're going to have a safety net for the real poor.
We're going to make this a great country.
Yeah, we're going to have a great society, which of course was founded on the shoals of another war based on lies, the Vietnam War. And so then, I mean, since 1975, it's been steadily going downhill. It accelerated with Reagan, and then the ultimate victory of Reaganomics, which shot everything, which shot the 1% to the top, and increasingly the middle class and the working class and the poor even more down the bottom. So everybody now, I'm making 25. Well, you're lucky to have a job. And I understand that fully. I mean, we all are, quote, lucky to have a job because our masters have granted us one, right?
We are peasants.
Yeah. Remember, that's what these conservatives say. Well, I've never seen a poor man give anyone a job. Remember
that was last week.
Yeah,
that was one of the most ridiculous comments on this show ever.
Yeah. I mean, that is like some attitude from feudalism, right?
Yeah.
The Lord. Yeah. Well, the Lord, I mean, although we live in huts, he lives in a huge manor, at least he gives us a little bit of field to. Well, I mean, let's get rebellious.
Defeated,
I mean, we live in the United States of America. It was supposed to be a colony of these lords and ladies and rulers and, where we were subjects. And we said, no, we're not going to do it. We're going to have a revolution. And that's not a revolution in hair coloring.
And if you go back, it's we the people. In fact, thanks for my pocket constitution that you gave me tonight.
Gave
such a great guy.
But in any event, back to the student budget hikes, the tuition hikes. I was thinking, so how do you do that? You're 20 years old. You barely, you know a few people in your class. Maybe you got a buddy or two you hang with, your boyfriend or girlfriend goes there. You know, all of this started somewhere. And I don't know, maybe you can't do it. But, I never started a revolution. tried. But
you've
just
joined in revolutions. We join in revolutions.
But it is possible
scales.
For one or some or even many of you out there, students, I'm just talking to students now, to say, you know, I'm not putting up with this crap. That I'm going to go to school tomorrow and I'm going to just talk to a couple of friends. And I'm going to say, what do you think we call a meeting and put up some flyers and say, let's have a meeting about these tuition hikes. And boy, isn't that kind of a rad professor that you got in sociology or history,
right,
or political science,
yeah,
or something like that? And ask him or her to say, well, you know, you go to these faculty meetings. We don't even know how to run a meeting. We've never done this before. But we're really mad, you know, that this is going on. Will you give us a help? In fact, maybe we'll even start a student organization, Students Against Tuition Hikes. And would you be our, what do they call it, campus sponsor? I think that's it, or something,
yeah,
like that. Yeah. Something. I mean, I don't even know the details, but it's about you. If you're listening and you're 20 years old, 22 years old, 19 years old, and you're accumulating all this debt, I don't want to tell the whole story again, but I came out of college with $5,000, you know,
It was some kind of lawsuit.
It was a lawsuit. I mean, but it was total luck. But the idea that you could come out, you know.
Without debt.
That what?
Without debt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not only without debt, but being like 23 years old, mm-hmm, and having money to begin life with, as opposed to owing $25,000, $35,000, $45,000, $50,000. So we're talking about your future here. Well, I am. And, you know, it's not about my future. It's about your future. And you really need to take care of it in some way or other. And the only way you are not just going to be an object to be worked upon by the people who run things is to get together with other people, to become what they call the subject. You start defining the agenda. You define the dialogue. I mean, if you can go
not
on...
Not many people go to that level. And that's...
No, but they did at different times. They did in the 1960s and 70s. Yeah. They did in the 1930s.
Yeah. And they do. It's just not here.
They did between, say, 1870 and 19, you know, in World War One and all that. I mean, people spoke up. I mean,
right.
And now they're, you know, we get mad when these cops pepper spray us back,
yes,
in the,
yes,
1880s to the 1940s. You know, the cops and the Pinkerton detectives and the company thugs and all that, they were shooting people.
Yeah, that's, you know, true.
They were killing people because people...
Our pepper spraying is pretty minor.
Yeah, yeah.
If you look at it.
Yeah, I mean, you see, you know, some cop bloodied a kid's nose, and boy, you know, we're saying, that's horrible. How unprofessional.
Right.
You know, other times in our history, they're just shooting people down because they wanted to only work 8 hours in a day. That was radical.
The people, not the cops. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Right.
All right, let's do this. I want to get you all on the air. Mike and Dustin, Daryl, you hang on. We'll take a quick break and be back to get your opinion.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Ever notice how people almost always have some good news and some bad news? But never good news and good news. Can people only handle so much good news? Let's see with car insurance. Good news. Esurance is now backed by the stability of Allstate, a company with over 80 years' experience. More good news. Esurance still offers the same great rates. So, everyone's still breathing? Visit esurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote.
Not available in all states.
This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the...
Why?
This Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. This is our second segment. We'd love to talk to you on the air. 313-298-WRIF. And at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, got a couple of great interviews. One of them about Facebook. It's called Talking Back to Facebook.
Oh.
Wow. We have a Facebook page.
Might have to listen to that on the way home.
Facebook.com/nightcall is where we're at, and always liking likes. Didn't you had an email there you were going to read?
No.
No.
You were going to read it, remember?
Okay. Let me see. I have to get to, oh, yeah. This is from Robert. He writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Good evening, Peter and Jalene. I'm curious if you are aware of the fact that Willard Mitt Romney was a draft dodger who weaseled his way out of military service during the Vietnam War. I shall share this link with you. And so I looked. It's actually very interesting. The name of the site is, well, you can go to realchange.org, and it's the skeletons in everyone's closet. All of the
politicians,
well,
like
presidential candidates, even Barack Obama.
I wouldn't want to be on one of those websites.
You'd have to have one all by yourself.
Thanks, Peter.
But here's what it writes. Mitt Romney, incredibly, was able to avoid serving in Vietnam because he was a big supporter of the war, because he was on his Mormon mission driving around the French countryside. The Mormon Church defined missions, which all good Mormon men, young one.
They have to go for like 2 years.
Yeah, as a form of priesthood. In fact, not one of Romney's five sons has served in the military either, despite Mitt arguing for U.S. military involvement in Iraq and elsewhere. When he was asked to justify this hypocrisy, Romney claimed his sons were serving the country by driving his Winnebagos around Iowa and campaigning for him. Which is true.
Really?
I remember that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And the whole site, though, is at my site, which, gee, I mean, websites, so 20th century.
But
it is Peter Werby, PETERWERB.com. Give a visit to that. All right, we're talking about Apple, which has employees that are long on loyalty but short on pay. They make $25,000 a year at the retail stores. Chinese production workers, where 92% of Apple production is carried out, much less. Timothy Cook, the CEO, made $378 million a year. My contention, I think Jalene joins me in this, is that these folks ought to take a lot less money and pay American workers a lot more money. And if they're going to
bring it back here,
if they're going to keep it over there, pay them, you know, the same wages. So that'll be a worldwide. What do you think about this? A worldwide minimum living wage.
You're going big now, Peter.
Going big now. Yeah, something popped through my mind, but I will think about it as we invite our call. Well, we'll take our invited callers.
Yes.
And put them on the air. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Dustin. Dustin, what's cooking?
Hey, what's up?
Dustin.
You're on the air.
Hi, Julene. It's Dustin from school.
Hi, Dustin from school.
Culinary school.
We cook together. I miss you. What's going on?
Oh, not much at all. I was on my way home from work. I thought I'd call and see if I got on.
You're on.
You did.
I can't believe it.
You know, there was a song from the 1920s. I wonder if you ever sang it to her. Hey, good looking, what you got cooking? How about cooking something up with me?
You probably did sing that.
Did you sing that to her?
Yeah, of course I did, dear.
He's kind of a cut up, that Dustin.
Yeah, cut up. Well,
but he likes the show, right, Dustin?
I do. I'm a big fan. You know, you're kind of speaking to the choir, but.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Well, we're glad you're in our choir.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Great.
Dustin, thanks for listening.
See you next semester.
Glad you got on the air. Yeah.
I'm going to come see him at his restaurant.
You think he could start the student revolt against budget hikes for tuition?
He and I might start it together.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
And you could kind of use that song. How about cooking, you know, all that stuff? That might work.
Hey, you never know.
Okay, let's get Daryl. Daryl's in Romulus, and Daryl spoke to us at the end of the show about bullying, and I told him to call back this week, and we'd address it a little more fully.
And then I accidentally hung up on you, Daryl. I apologize.
Daryl, you're on the air, so tell us about bullying and your concerns.
Okay, the bullying has got to stop, because now, instead of just pushing and shoving and hurting people, now the guns are breaking out.
Whoa, that's bullying.
I know, it's all bullying. Back in September 10th of 1976 is when I went to the plate glass window backwards.
Man.
I was really shoved.
Yeah.
And it happened at a Kmart store in Southgate, believe it or not.
Uh-huh.
And 77 stitches, 4 veins cut in the back of my head, my hands all messed up. I have wires in my fingers for the tendons and the muscles. I'm still having issues with both of my hands. These bullies have got to realize the psychological part of what they do to the victim lasts for the rest of their lives, not just for that split moment. It lasts for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, emotionally and physically.
Yeah, and you remember, yeah. I mean, the fact that that thing with Mitt Romney when he was out at Cranbrook, a rich kid's school out a little north of here, when they held that kid who either was gay or they thought was gay and held him down and cut his hair off, right?
Yeah.
I remember you talking about that, and that's all wrong, too.
Yeah, it is. Bullying. Yeah.
I mean, the kids, the victims are the ones that are retaliating, and that's not going to get nowhere either. It's uh-huh. by retaliation against the bullying. My parents were like, stay away from them. Don't talk to them. Well, it's kind of hard if you're in the same school they are. They literally hunt you down.
Yeah.
They put you in lockers and all that junk.
You know, I got to tell you, Daryl, my memory from school is that the bullies were always triumphant, that the victims never got to retaliate.
No, they never did. I'm going back to Columbine, too, because I think that those two were victims, and they brought out the guns, and they shoot up half the school. I mean,
yeah, that's not a great response.
No, it's not. No. And that's where the teachers and that's where the parents ought to step up to the plate and say, hey, these kids have got to be expelled. That's what they're doing now. If that law would have been effect back when I was in school,
yeah,
I think it would have stopped. Even in your workplace now, your workplace has got bullies as well. They've grown up from being childhood bullies to now to adult bullies. They look you down and they just freaking do whatever they want now.
Well, there has been an increased awareness of it.
Absolutely, yeah, and there was that movie. I mean, there is so much talk about it, and that's the good news here.
Yeah, I think so. And there's certainly organizations about that. I know I do public service announcements for seminars for teachers, you know, how to become more aware of it. Because when I was a kid, and I never bullied anybody, but there was kind of a gang of roughnecks.
Yeah.
We were all out and we went, oh no, here comes, you know, and
the gang, the group, guys.
All right, Daryl, listen up. I'll talk a little more about it, but thanks for reminding us about that. We went to this movie one time and suddenly we were confronted by this gang of bullies, and this kid says to me, my friend said you could beat me up.
What?
I said, no, I never said that. He said, you calling my friend a liar?
Oh, no.
Bam.
Wow.
And, you know, well, all right.
Poor Peter.
It was all right. I made it through.
That's why you're so tough.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't even want to fight back because there was, like, more of them, and I knew if
you're toast.
Well, yeah, yeah. Here's Alex in Romulus. Alex, Peter, and Jalene, thanks for calling us. You're on the air.
Yes, how you doing?
Good.
Good, hi.
Good. I was just listening to your handbook about the Constitution and how the middle class is tending to fall out and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a lot of protection, you know, out there. There's a lot of things that... people necessarily may figure that isn't the best recourse. And, there's one thing that's out there. It's called the Mixed Militia.
Yeah.
And I know the word may scare people.
Well,
but
Those guys are...
They're still there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
A lot of them are still behind bars, aren't they?
No, no. They were doing... They kind of went a little... They kind of mainstream.
What are you saying?
That's the last thing in the world.
What are you saying?
That's the last thing in the world we need. I mean...
What do you mean that's the last thing in the world you need?
Well, I can't say it any plainer.
Really?
I mean, if you started making a list of everything we need, they'd be around number 496. I mean, people running around in camo with guns and all that.
Paranoid.
And talking about the government
the end of the world.
And all of that. I mean, you know, what do we need that for?
That's not really what they talk about, though.
Well, are you in this? Is this what you're telling us?
I mean, a militia... It is, by its very nature, an armed group of men or people, and we have an open, well, let me say it this way, an ostensibly open political system that we still have the right to organize for. We don't have to, you know, be taking up arms or anything like that. For one thing, only thing it ever does is wind up getting people in trouble. If you're right-wing militias, like most of the ones that we've heard about, including the Michigan militia, well, then, you know, you get invited on radio programs and what have you. If you had, like, an African-American militia, or if you had a left-wing militia, mm-hmm. you'd probably, you know, you'd have SWAT squads down on them in a second. So they actually feed into the far right, and that's not what we need right now. All right, Alex, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I mean, here's what...
Play a little paintball, man.
Yeah, there you go. Paintball. That's good. Yeah. That's fun. Hey, one of the things that I would said to him, though, that the political system is ostensibly open. By the way, there's open lines at 313-298-WRIF. And ostensibly because the electoral system, I don't know whether you can call that open or not.
True.
Yeah. There's an article. I can almost read this whole thing. It's pretty long. It's what Sheldon Adelson wants. I think they call him Adelson sometimes.
Adelson, but explain who that is.
Yeah. He is the CEO of this gambling, they don't say who he is. Oh, the casino magnate. He's made more money in the last 3 years than any other American.
What? Is he on that list? Oh, wait, no, this is private versus public.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's a perfect illustration, says the New York Times editorial, of the squalid state of political money, spending sums greater than any political donation in the history of this country to advance his personal, ideological, and financial agenda, which is wildly at odds with the nation's needs.
Now, I remember this name mostly because he was the one that gave $20 million to Newt Gingrich.
To Newt Gingrich. Remember him?
Yeah, I'm glad.
Remember all those guys?
I'm not having to think about him.
Hey, you know, we never remembered the name of the guy from Godfather Pizza.
Wait!
It's coming.
Herman Cain. I did it.
999.
crazy.
It turned out to be N-E-I-N. You know, German.
Like no, no,
no, no. No. Yeah, 99. Right. Anyway, so yeah, Adelson. Spent $20 million propping up Newt Gingrich's failed candidacy. He's now given $10 million to a Mitt Romney's super PAC. He's given another $10 million to a group funded by and founded by Karl Rove. And another $10 million will probably go to the similar group founded by the Koch brothers.
And
K-O-C-H.
With the $10 million, it's for attack ads against Obama and other Democrats across the country.
Yeah, so it's $60 million that we know of. Other huge donations may be secret, and it may only be a down payment. Mr. Adelson has made it clear he will fully exploit the anything-goes world created by federal courts to donate a limitless portion of his $25 billion fortune to defeat the president and as many Democrats as he can take down.
I mean, if you've got 25 bill hanging around, what's 60
what does he
mil,
even care?
Right? Yeah,
well, he's a Jewish American, and one of the things that he really is over the...
Israel.
Is about Israel, because President Obama, and as well as most Israelis, support a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So because of that, he wants to get rid. He's the right. He's further to the right than even the main pro-Israeli lobbying group, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC.
That's tough to do.
Yeah. And let's see, he's also, according to the Times, he's concerned about his own wallet. Now, how in the world, why in the world would he even care about that if he's got a $25 billion? Say, he said, oh, yeah, we're going to raise taxes 50% on you. He'd say, yeah, so what?
I know.
Yeah, I can buy you and your mama.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and, absolutely. And your whole family.
But he's just buying Newt Gingrich. Adelson rails against the president's, quote, socialist-style economy and redistribution of wealth. Well, there's a redistribution of wealth going on, but it's not going towards...
people who need it.
People who need it, or people... It's not going from people like him to people below him. It's going from all of us, the 99% below him.
Up.
Mr. 1%, you said the word.
Up.
Up, yep. And let's see, what he really fears is Mr. Obama's proposal to raise taxes on companies like his that make a huge amount of money overseas. 90% of the earnings of his company, this is this guy who is funding Newt Gingrich, did fund Newt Gingrich now, Mitt Romney, the Las Vegas Sands Corporation, they come from, his 90% of his profits come, earnings come from hotel and casino properties in Singapore and Macau. The latter is located, by the way, in China, a socialist country, the last time we checked.
Right.
Because of the lower tax rate in those countries, currently zero in Macau, the company now has a United States corporate tax rate of 9.8% compared with the statutory rate of 35%. President Obama has repeatedly proposed ending the deductions and the credits that allow corporations like Las Vegas Sands to shelter billions in income overseas, but has been blocked by the Republicans. This is absolutely incredible. Adelson, though, I remember we were talking at the beginning of the show that there no longer is any group of, I don't know, of a category of American elite worthy of emulation or respect.
Yeah.
Politicians, religious leaders.
Entertainers.
Entertainers, CEO guys. Because Adelson's Macau operations is being investigated by the Justice Department to see whether it violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
I wonder.
Yeah. For such a man as Adelson, at a time when there are no legal or moral limits to the purchase of influence, spending tens of millions is a pittance to elect Republicans who promise to keep his billions intact. So you got to realize when these people are giving millions and millions and millions and millions, they're not doing it because they care about good government.
Right.
Wow. All
right. Imagine if they took all that money and just did one good thing with it.
Yeah. You know, actually, I was going to start, George from Manchester, I was going to start with you back to our phones, but I'd have to cut you short because we got to go to commercials. So George in Manchester, we got Dave in Eastern Colorado.
Great.
We'll talk to him.
Welcome.
Fred in Detroit, Mike in Fenton. You're all next. Hold on.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
Yeah. Detroit's Rock Station. On the web, thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
see through you, see your true colors inside your ugly light. I can see through you, see to the real you.
You guys just thrive on pushing the limits.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Ah, that's the sweet spot.
The Riff. You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Right after what?
We're back. Right, I don't know.
Jade?
She put it, she's in trouble again.
Yeah, she is.
It's okay. My
gosh.
Love
her, though.
Yeah, we do. She saves us more than she does this.
She bombs us, yeah. Anyway, whatever.
It just stops you dead in your tracks.
Yeah, it does. It does.
When things like that happen.
Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. Likes are liked. And it's also a place where we get information. People usually would just email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. But a little earlier, we were talking about letting our freak flag fly, and I said, isn't that from an old classic rock song? But I said, that was Jimi Hendrix.
If Six Was Nine.
And then someone posted on Facebook, right?
That's what it was, yeah, If Six Was Nine.
Yeah, they pasted on Facebook, right?
They did. Yes, they did. Jerry did. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you, Jerry.
Oh, and we have Mary Bell listening from Kansas, and Kathy listening from Windsor.
Wow.
So,
we're bad. We're international.
Yeah.
It'll be at 1:30 a.m. I'm going to be interviewing Paul R. Ehrlich, this incredible guy that's been around forever. I think it was in the 60s he wrote The Population Bomb, saying that we're going to wind up with the other way around.
Too many people.
We're going to, yeah. Wasn't that a Paul McCartney song? Thinking of classic rock. Anyway, there's too many people. And everybody said, oh, you know, you're terrible, you're wrong, your projections are ridiculous, it's racist, it's, you know, first worldism, all that stuff. And most of what he said has come true.
Yes, absolutely.
So he'll be on at 1:30 at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. It will be, what is his name? Stryer. Can't think of his first name. Anyway, he's written a book called Talking Back to Facebook, which I thought was really interesting. Okay, even though we do Facebook. Because he's hanging
you
on.
You kind of have to in this day and age.
Yeah, let's go to Dave. He's in Eastern Colorado. Dave, how'd you hook on to our show? You're on the air.
Oh, I check in periodically. I've actually talked to you before.
I remember this. We've talked to you, yeah.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Julene. Hi, Vicki and Windsor, if you're listening.
Huh.
I'm going from Denver to Texas with 10 tons of reefer.
With
10 tons
of reefer.
20,000 pounds of frozen food in a refrigerated trailer.
Freezer. I thought you said reefer.
Like, damn, you're bold.
Wait a minute. Let's go back, Dave. You did not say 10,000 pounds of reefer, did you?
I did.
Oh, you did?
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good. Good.
Reefer is trucker speak for refrigerated trailers.
Oh.
We got it. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
We thought it was something else.
Thank you.
I don't know. I guess there's other prescribed substances like the pollen trailer as well.
But.
We're talking about the bad days of the labor movement when it was easier to get shot than it is now.
Yeah.
I was in the IWW for a while, and I read Fifth Estate for a long time. And
oh, great.
Seemed to be a tendency on the left end of labor where they thought that this semi-legalization was maybe not such a good thing. It would kind of soften people up after a while. They would forget how to struggle. And it was a little bit too close to the German and Italian fascist models for them, where the labor movement would become sort of a semi-official branch of government.
Which officially is what, without getting real technical about all, what fascism is, what they call the vertical integration of classes. Yeah, exactly, where everything is under the control of the state. Yeah, but I don't know, you know, it cuts a lot of different ways. The IWW that they've mentioned is the Industrial Workers of the World. For some reason or other, they were called Wobblies. and they still exist. You can go to IWW.org. And they didn't want any labor contracts. They just wanted direct action. In fact, one of their slogans was, direct action will get you satisfaction. Right, Dave?
But they had shops in Cleveland and Detroit in the late 40s, you know, 40s and 50s.
They did.
That had contracts under the labor laws, exactly the same as anyone else.
Well, they kind of had to. I mean, if you're like a revolutionary union, like the IWW was, or some of the syndicalist unions in Italy, other places, Spain and what have you, I mean, either you got to have a revolution or you got to, you know, like that more classic rock quotes, you stare into the vacuum of his eyes and say, hey, buddy, can we make a deal, from the Dylan song, right? I don't know. I mean, I don't know where you go with it. But yeah, I mean, in order to stop, the Roosevelt, there's a tendency among the liberals on the left to look back on the Roosevelt era as this sort of, golden age. But one of the reasons that Roosevelt, who was part of the 1%, wanted to allow unions and pass what was called the Wagner Act that gave the go-ahead for unions to organize, is that he and the other people in the 1% were very fearful that because of the economic collapse of the 30s, that unions like the IWW or the widespread organizing efforts of the Communist Party at that time would lead to some sort of revolutionary upsurge as it had in other countries. And I said last week there were general strikes and what have you. So they said, hey, come on, let's cut some deals.
Right? My grandfather was involved with the Flint GM1 sit down. He was in Detroit, but, you know, he was up there a lot. My mother had memories, you know, childhood stories of crazy things happened when she had to go along with him because there was no place else for him to be, and he would tell her to get, you know, down on the floor under the dash, and then he'd brush the broken glass off her after they got inside the plant.
Wow.
Man.
Well, I don't know. Those days, you never can tell because, what's happened? We were mentioning earlier about just in Quebec, hundreds of thousands of people marching and not labor unions are involved. This is just over student tuition. And the police are getting very violent. And, ultimately, the protective arm of the state is as violent as it has to be. I mean, at some point that even the rulers in the 1930s who had been shooting down workers for the last 50 or 60 years to stop their demands for unionization and decent wages and safety conditions that thought, you know, look, we're making enough money here at GM and Ford. Let's let these unions be part of the production process. For one thing, they agree not to strike. They can't go out on wildcat strikes every time there's something they don't like. So they got something out of it, and they shared the wealth a little teeny bit, and it lasted for what they call the Great Compression, is that huge gulf between the very rich and the average person actually shrunk considerably. There was a redistribution of wealth in this country. But at some point, the greed heads at the top just said, screw this. I mean, why do we have to do this? Let's take it all. And as I said last week,
slowly take it away.
Yeah. Well, and it's going faster and faster. We'll just pass out thatch. The peasants
thatch your roofs.
So can thatch their roofs. All right, Dave, thanks a lot. Thanks for bringing all that up. I appreciate it. I hope it wasn't too obscure. You know, if it is, and probably a little of it was what I was saying, and it all tweaks your imagination, you just got to do a little investigation. Like the story of the industrial workers of the world, absolutely incredible story.
It's all out there.
It's all out
there. You have the internet.
Absolutely. Well, people have been waiting some long time, but I'll get you on. 313-298-WRIF. Here's George. George is in Manchester. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, it's Jimmy from Manchester.
Okay.
Hi, Jimmy.
Yeah.
They got George.
Doing?
They got George down here, but whatever.
Good.
Hi, Jimmy.
Well, okay. No big deal. I just called to thank you for,
George? Jimmy?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I got cut off or something.
No.
I thought he was thanking us for nothing.
Yeah.
I called to thank you for talking about how we're all subjects and talking about how the Constitution sets you free from being a subject.
Right.
Awesome.
Okay.
Thank you so much for doing that.
Right. We are citizens with rights.
That's right. That's right.
So what's up?
What's that?
I said, what's up?
Oh, that's what's up. I was listening to your show, and I heard
you called to compliment. To thank.
Okay.
And I called. I had the, you know, when you and I have talked before, and we don't agree all the time.
That's okay.
Well, that happens a lot.
That's okay.
Yeah.
But it is. When you do something that's good, I want to point it out.
Well,
I want to point out to everyone.
What do they call that, Peter?
Damned by faint praise?
Backhanded.
Oh, yeah, that's what it is. I'm going to put you a picture up next to Mark Kornke's in my house.
Who?
Who?
What?
I don't know.
Kornke?
I think it's a porn star.
Oh, right. My God.
Jimmy, thank you. Appreciate it.
We can't go 1 week without something like that.
No,
right?
No. I'm only kidding. I don't. How would I know?
Well, you know, there's like the porn stars that everyone, like Johnny Holmes, remember?
That's like from the Jimi Hendrix.
Is it just
era.
Me?
Yeah. Yeah. No. I mean, name a porn star of the 21st century. Not a
female?
Johnny Wad Holmes died like in 1977 or something.
How about the Hedgehog?
You know more about this than I do. What did the Hedgehog?
Listen, if you are a chick who works at a rock station, you know these things.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'll tell you on the break.
Okay. But Mike and Fred, hold on. I just want to bring something else up. Well, now that the Republicans, fixing the state, now they have control of everything from the governorship to both houses of the legislature to the Supreme Court. And so now they're fixing everything. Like, so now we can get all the fireworks we want. So my neighbors can just blow them off.
It's going on, too.
Yeah, they can just blow them off all the time.
My neighbor down the street, you know, love the guy, but do we have to have this every night?
Well, here's what Mayor Jim Fouts, I think it is, of Warren.
It is.
Yeah. Thanks to the Michigan legislature's misguided 2011 decision to allow Ohio-style major fireworks, such as Roman candles and heavy-duty firecrackers, Michigan residents now face major dangers.
One landed about 3 inches from my neighbor's dog the other night.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
The act prohibits local communities from protecting residents from hazards and nuisance fireworks may cause. This reverses decades of state laws designed to protect children from being maimed by explosive devices, pets from unwanted noise, seniors from sleep disruption and deprivation, and homes from flash fires brought on by wayward fireworks.
All good things.
Yeah.
All important.
The state gains a licensing fee of $600 to $1,000. Oh, from the seller, I guess.
Okay.
And
so
6% tax from fireworks sold, while cities get the honor of enforcement without any financial gain.
Right, right.
And it goes on, let's see, they're talking about, I've received numerous complaints from Warren residents about this potential disaster in the making. And then he lists what has happened so far to residents of Warren, Michigan. How many more garage fires will there be? How many more children will have their fingers, hands, and other limbs blown off by fireworks? The Fireworks Safety Act. I mean, that's always interesting. The Republicans always do that kind of,
with their terminology.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
make everything sound so happy.
It's costly,
good.
Both to the cities and the safety of all state residents. Now, I know. I mean, there must be enough people that like blowing off fire. I mean, I actually love fireworks.
Going to the Detroit fireworks tomorrow night.
Yeah, yeah. And WRF will be there, right?
Yes.
Yep. And also, we go around to some of the smaller cities and see them as well. Some of them do a great
job. Down by our house.
Yeah.
Houses.
And it's interesting. Last, speaking about fireworks, I kind of scammed my way into this high-end dinner that was being served at the top of the Ren Center. If you're not listening around.
You scammed your way in? Doesn't sound very good,
Peter. I guess it wasn't a scam. I mean, it was a fundraiser, and it was way out of my pay grade.
This was last year. You said last
year.
Week. Yeah.
Oh, did I? Last year. Thank you.
Okay.
Last year. And so we went to the top of the Renaissance Center. This
I recall.
Very tall. And the fireworks. I mean, Detroit fireworks are absolutely amazing.
You were going down there. I couldn't believe you were going down there.
And we were.
And your wife went. She
She's never again.
Yeah.
And we were at the level of the fireworks.
That had to be amazing.
But you know what? You know what? We were behind glass.
So you couldn't hear?
You could hear some, well, the explosions or the, you know, from firing it. They're at the bottom. But they are spectacular. I mean,
they
really are incredible. So those are good. And I know some people that all year would buy fireworks from out of state and then like out at a lake where they went, they would blow them all mm-hmm. off and all that. So, I mean, I'm not like saying, I mean, you know, oh, they're terrible.
You're not being a fun hater.
Not being a fun hater, but man, you know, blowing them off night after night after night.
It's obnoxious. Well, and especially like on weeknights.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe what people should do, if they're into it, maybe they should
go out to the country.
Yeah. Or have a little sense of propriety.
Okay.
Well, all right, some open lines. We're at 313-298-WRIF. Here is Mike and Fenn. Mike, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. You remind me of Robin Hood and Jolene. You remind me of Jonah. What is her name? Joan of Arc?
Joan of Arc, yeah.
Yeah, but I hope it doesn't turn out for her like it did for her.
Yeah, I know. Robin Hood did all right. Robin Hood, yeah. You know, think
yeah,
about...
Yeah, I hope so, too.
A friend of mine, I should have the name of this book, wrote a book about Robin Hood. Here is this absolutely enduring figure that essentially ripped off wealthy people.
Because he gave to the poor.
When I, why can't I think of his name? Paul Buell, B-U-H-L-E, B-U-H-L-E, Paul Buell, Robin Hood. Google that, you'll find his book. And I opened up the interview, which some of you may have heard, with saying if the scene was downtown and all of a sudden there's a group of people from Birmingham, or yeah. Grosse Pointe or West Bloomfield or something like mm-hmm. that, and they're confronted by some armed poor people that say, give us all your money and your jewels, and we heard about that, we'd be outraged. We'd be saying the city has gone to hell in
yeah.
a handbasket.
Yeah, can't even go downtown anymore.
But that's what Robin Hood did.
Yeah. But it was a different time. And
I
now,
guess so.
You know, look at the crime in Detroit.
Yeah. And we need a Robin Hood tax. That's one of the
yes.
things that's called for.
Yes.
But, Mike, we're taking away your time. Go ahead. Talk.
Okay. Yeah, hey, if I was going to start a revolution, you guys would probably be the first people I'd call. And, Peter, I think I'd put your picture next to Chairman Mao.
Well, I don't know. Well, no, he wasn't.
Now, listen, Peter doesn't get along with the Maoists. He, he tore one a new head right in front of me many years ago.
Yeah, they... You know, they had that Beatles song at one time that it was...
we're doing classic rock.
I want to change the world. If you're talking about destruction, you can count me out. So we do need the revolution, but we don't need the violent type.
But you know...
Nonviolent resistance.
In that Beatles song, the lyrics are something like, what is it? If you're carrying pictures of Chairman Mao... won't get you anywhere anyhow. Boy, those guys were lyricists. But, you know, there's one version of the song. It's on the White Album, but there's another part of it where it said, if you're talking about destruction, you can count me out. And then John, though, goes in, you know. So he was trying to be...
No, it's going to be all right.
John, yeah, that's a... John was down with the Revo.
Yeah, for sure.
The poor people. I want to talk about the poor people.
Okay.
Yeah, The fellow that was on there last week, he's saying poor people don't create any jobs.
They don't provide jobs, right.
Yeah, right. That's just like so wrong. The poor people provide more jobs than anybody else because they gave all this money to the rich people. They created no jobs. The only thing that kept this economy going was the poor people spending their money because these rich people, they didn't spend any money in this downturn. They hung on to all the money.
They did. In fact, when we were talking earlier...
Had the money.
Yeah. About the CEO of Apple, Timothy Cook, making $378 million in 1 year. So he's not spending that. I mean, what would he spend it on? But he's paying his workers in the United States, forgetting about his slave wages in China, that $25,000 a year for selling like $750,000 worth of Apple products at a store. But if he was to if the whole company was to take less profit, he would say make a measly $4 or $5 million a year. Really cut him. Only make $4 or $5 million a year. Just think of, and he would double everybody's salary that works for him besides being a national hero. all of a sudden, all this, as you're saying, all this money would be, you know, into the economy. So that makes a lot of sense. All right, Mike, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here, I forgot a little earlier, by the way, we were talking about, we were calling for students to stand up to these tuition increases. Now, one of the things, I'm surprised somebody didn't say, hey, look, these universities don't have money. I mean, they're not doing it because they're going to put it in their pocket. These are state universities that we're talking about. Their costs go up, they have to pass it along. The question is, why isn't there enough money in the wealthiest country in the world to provide not cheaper tuition, but no tuition?
How about just provide a free education?
Free educational system, right. And let's see, David wrote in, because a little earlier when we were, Dave in Detroit, he wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and I mentioned earlier MTU, and what I was thinking, I think there is like a friend of mine taught at Tennessee, but anyway. But MTU is Michigan Technological University in Houghton in UP, in the UP. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's what he meant.
Yeah, in the UP.
Did not click for me.
Yeah, yeah.
The way he spelled it.
Yeah, and we were talking about if you were a student and you'd enlist the help of a faculty member, he says, yeah, the term is faculty advisor. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We like when you clarify things. In a while, we need the help.
He sent me a picture of Bush on a steak.
Last week.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah, but he's got steak.
But it was.
It was on a
piece of meat.
Oh,
yeah.
Not steake.
Yeah.
He says, do you want me to send it again? No.
It's funny.
Yeah, was it?
I mean, it's
a no wonder
piece
I didn't
meat.
Get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. All right. Let's see. One of the things that I wanted to talk about. Oh, yeah. This is pretty interesting. A guy named David Blankenhorn, a national figure in the movement against same-sex marriage, has recanted his opposition, saying, quote, the time has come for me to accept gay marriage and emphasize the good that it can do.
Can you believe it?
No.
I mean, of course, you read the headline and you start reading it. I thought, oh, what's the ulterior motive here, right? But there wasn't.
No, there wasn't, yeah. He was the founder and president of the Institute for American Values, wrote an influential book that argued against same-sex marriage in 2007, 5 years ago, and served as an expert witness against the constitutional challenge to California's Proposition 8, which limited marriage to heterosexuals.
That part really PO'd me off there.
Yeah. He said, pardon me, at the time, I'm going into my Godfather mode. There's going to come a time.
You're okay. One more segment, you can do it.
Then I'm going to need a favor. I want to be able to call upon you.
Peter, carry on.
But he said, I oppose gay marriage, believing that children have the right, insofar as society makes it possible, to know and to be cared for by the two parents who brought them into this world. Do you agree, Jolene, that in fact that that's probably the absolute best situation? I do.
No.
No. Okay. I didn't think you would. But you know what? A step below that is not bad. I mean, it's not awful. It's not terrible. A single parent,
I just think if you love your child, that's all that matters.
I agree. I don't, but,
that's
well,
it.
You know what?
Nurture.
You know what? Probably what it means is, and I'll take that back. I won't agree with it. That because you can have two parents that are awful.
Yes, you can.
Right?
Or you can have two parents and one of them is awful.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. He said he still held that conviction, the man who now recognizes the right of gays to marry. However, he says whatever one's definition of marriage, legally recognizing gay and lesbian couples and their children is a victory for basic fairness. He never cited the Bible or anything like that. Reverend Jim Garlow, senior pastor of Skyline Wesleyan Church in La Mesa, California. He's dead wrong. I'm a student of history. Christianity has made that clear that marriage is between one man and one woman. Well, that's 100% correct. Christianity has made it. But you know what? When you get married, you know what you're
but
getting?
It's a bunch of hooey anyway.
Yeah. Whoever, what? What's hooey? Religion?
Okay. Yes, I mean, we think
wait,
that,
wait.
But Okay.
When a pastor or a rabbi or an imam or anybody marries you, he is acting as a representative of the political state.
Right. But there are Christians who believe in homosexuality or they are accepting of it.
Oh, yeah.
Episcopalian.
Yeah, gay churches.
Yeah, Unitarian churches.
Yeah. But no, here, I don't know if it's clear what I'm talking about. What I mean is that every marriage is a civil ceremony performed with a religious trappings if you get like a pastor to do it or a priest to do it.
Yeah.
Right?
If you get keywords.
Yeah. Yeah. But so this whole thing about who marries who isn't, you know, say that Christianity has made it clear that marriage is between one man and one woman. So what? I mean, that's
their religion.
That doesn't
mean other people can't have some type of ceremony and unite in love and live their lives together.
Right? Here's the good news. 2/3 of people under 40 approve of marriage equality.
How many?
2/3.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. I mean, let's get with it, people. Come on.
Yeah. Mr. Blankenhorn, who was raised in the South, attended Harvard. Oh, well.
Yeah.
Has long stood out among opponents of same-sex marriage because he did not invoke a biblical or religious justification and did not oppose civil unions for gay men and lesbians. Instead, he argued that marriage was society's most important institution.
Yeah, that's going to hell in a handbasket and has been for decades.
But he says it has come under attack. How's it come under attack?
Yeah, that's a bunch of crap.
Yeah, a bunch of, well, tell us what you really think.
Hooey.
Yeah. But, I mean, think about it this way. Well, under attack, how is it under attack? I mean, if you go back...
Because gay people want to get married. That's his point. That's ridiculous,
yeah,
isn't
it? Yeah, it is. Yeah. And about, I mean, think about humor. In fact, you know what? You can go back, humor back to the Middle Ages. And men make jokes about marriage being the ball and chain. And,
Sure,
I wish I was single again. And, you know, all of that stuff. Wedding bells are breaking up that old gang of mine.
That's funny.
I have to listen sometimes to this 40s station that my wife listens to.
Really?
When she's not rocking with the riff.
Right, which she is a rocker.
She is a rocker.
Wife of yours.
Yeah. So, all right, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF, and let's see, here is Fred. Fred's in Detroit. Fred, hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Fred.
Jolene, you're going to hell, and I'm right behind you.
All right, come on with me, baby.
Well, you know,
let's go.
The quote I always use, right, from Mark Twain: "Heaven for the climate, hell for the company."
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to. Well, I got about four quick things. The first is touching on last week.
Yeah.
And what you were saying about what people believe concerning this economy, what they will believe and what they don't believe. And I just wanted to remind people if there's an alphabet of government agencies who have statistics saying that drilling for oil and natural gas is much greater than it was before the whole BP spill thing, that manufacturing is greater than it was before the downturn in the economy. You know, a lot of it's automated and whatnot, but still, you know, the numbers are there. Drilling and manufacturing are high.
Well, you remember, you know, Obama, who did not say this artfully, he said that the private sector...
Which he usually does.
Yeah, well, the private sector was doing fine. But what's happening is that the government, that private employment has been slowly adding workers for the last 2 years, but where the economy is still being held down is by the layoffs of public workers.
Right.
Yeah.
In fact, this from the New York Times. I think you're looking at the same thing I am, Peter. For example, in California, the governor is threatening to eliminate 15,000 state jobs. When school begins in Cleveland this fall, more than 500 teachers will probably not have jobs. In Trenton, which has already cut 1/3 of its police force.
This is Trenton, New Jersey, not Michigan.
Right. Yeah. Hundreds. Thank you for clarifying that. Hundreds of school district employees and at least 150 other public workers. The only way the city will forestall the loss of 60 more firefighters is if a federal grant comes through. I mean, these are too important of jobs.
And in the meantime, speaking of jobs, it brings me back to Timothy D. Cook, who's making
CEO of Apple.
$388 million income. I mean, why doesn't he pass a little bit of it along to folks in Trenton, New Jersey?
To anyone? Like, how about, let's start with his employees.
Yeah.
Well, I want to tell you, too, about a highly ironic ad that's running now from ExxonMobil, who would die without oil subsidies.
Right.
They're bemoaning the fact that U.S. students are probably 17th behind a bunch of other westernized countries.
Yeah, because we're paying more attention to
science and math
corporations than our educational system.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know what they plan to do if they're not going to offer up anything, any solutions. And as far as college-age kids are, I believe they're too busy trying to survive in and out of school, and they're too tied to those eye toys that you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, you know, as far as social life.
Yeah.
And whatnot, to get out there and really do what they need to do to get tuition down. So they're torn.
It's all of these protests and movements can't be through Facebook, right, Fred?
That's exactly. Right. Well, stay tuned, Fred, and the rest of it. 1 a.m. we'll be doing a show. I'll be doing an interview talking back to Facebook. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Now, since its post-recession peak in April 2009, the public sector has been shrunk by 706,000 jobs. And I'm sure there's some of you out there thinking, good, get them all off there. Well, I mean, that means you're getting less services. I
I mean, if your house is on fire because of this law that Snyder brought into effect about the fireworks.
Yeah. Could government be more efficient? Sure. But the problem isn't, you know, people have said, oh, you know, these public sector workers and all their demands through their unions and all that. There was no problem paying this before, and when you have, boy, I'm like a broken record, we're in the richest country in the world, why are cities going bankrupt? Could you, for instance, consolidate services? Could you have, like, regional police rather than local police? I don't know, whatever happened to those bumper stickers, support your local police. It will say, support your regional police.
Right. Good luck.
I mean, do you need, in like an area around where we live, do we need 8 separate police forces and, you know, maybe, I forget whether, maybe 6 fire departments and all that? Maybe it could, but.
What do you mean? I didn't get that.
Well, you...
covering meant that cities at once?
If you have, like, Ferndale, Pleasant Ridge, Oak Park, Southfield, Madison Heights, you know, Hazel Park. I mean, does every single city need a police department, which means that you have all these administrators, all these...
offices.
All these offices. Well, you would need probably still the offices.
But, I mean, people who work... Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I know we always have a lot of police officers
listening.
What about that? What about regional police to save money? I mean, because most...
That's already happening where we're broadcasting. I mean, you know, we already have a couple of different...
Well, Royal Oak Township here is being is being patrolled by the state police.
It's the state police. We know this. It's the state police and the Oakland County Sheriff's Office.
Yeah.
Our friends. Thank you. Love you guys.
Hey, we're going to take a break. Mark in Southgate wants to talk about that new bridge, and Brenton Taylor.
And that's the bridge to Canada.
Yeah, not the bridge to nowhere.
Yes, which sometimes we're on this country.
We'll be right back with our final segment. Join us.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. Detroit Rock Station, on the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
Why did I choose a little one?
Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. It's our last segment. Please join us. I'd like to hear what you have to say. One of the big controversies of the evening is about classic rock lyrics. We were saying that Jimi Hendrix had... had the line, "I'm going to let my freak flag fly."
Well,
actually,
someone wrote in and said that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That it wasn't that. Yeah. They said, I thought it was Hendrix. And they said, yeah, it was in If Six Was Nine. But actually, what he said is, well, here's the, I love this lyric. It's a long song for, you know, Hendrix, about 6.5 minutes. White collar conservatives flashing down the street, pointing their plastic finger at me. They're hoping soon my kind will drop and die. But I'm going to wave my freak flag high.
Love it.
Love it. That's
Jimmy.
Hendrix. That's a Hendrix thing. But I'm going to let my freak flag fly came from David Crosby in the Crosby, Stills, and Nash & Young Almost Cut My Hair, which was written upon what historic occurrence? The assassination of Robert Kennedy. That's why, you know, I get looking
that.
In my rearview mirror and seeing a police car, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Police? God, give me a break, guys.
What do you mean by that?
Well, that's not the way guys like him say police.
I don't know. I heard a song earlier. It was a white guy saying it like that. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who cares, Peter?
Wow, that's this is weird from Chris. This is from calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Tell pro Ayn Rand lovers to form anti-commune communities to prove how well it works. If slacker stoners can do it, why can't clean-cut all-Americans do better?
I don't get it.
I think it's a poem.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Let's go back to our poems.
I'm lost.
Yeah. No, I don't get it either. But, it, you know, it has a nice cadence.
Oh, I like the cadence. Yeah, I do.
Cadence,
very nice.
Say.
Very nice.
You can, you've been in the studio recording. I mean.
Yes.
And I don't think those lyrics are copyrighted.
Well, what?
You could use them.
Oh, no. I don't like using other people's lyrics.
No.
Like
all right,
own.
Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. We've got a new bridge coming. Here's Mark in Southgate. Mark, hi, you're on the air. What do you think about that bridge?
I don't know. I don't know. Where exactly is it going to go over on our side? Do you know?
It's going down river somewhere.
Yeah.
But
so,
right. But nobody seems to know where.
It's going to take your home. It's going to go.
No, I don't think that'll happen.
No. I don't know either.
Not funny.
But what I heard was it is going to connect directly to an expressway in Canada.
Well, yeah, I know which I all of a sudden I can't. The one, well, I don't know what it goes. The 401, as
right.
They call it. Thaw.
Which
they put
is,
the
and the ambassador article takes you downtown, right?
No. The tunnel takes you. The Detroit to Windsor tunnel takes you to downtown Windsor. But the... Yeah, no, the bridge takes you out on, I don't know, I've done it so many times, I don't know why I can't think of it, but it takes you, maybe, I don't know, what, this probably means nothing to people that are listening in other cities, trying to mumble about what number
where
of what.
Where does it take you?
Yeah. But, you know, I don't, on the face of it, it seems good. Get all of those trucks off the Ambassador Bridge, stop them from going through all the neighborhoods and, but maybe that'll just send it, you know, down
to a different neighborhood.
Yeah. But I don't know.
But I think it will, you know, make the waiting time a little bit less and decongest things, I would think.
Well, I think it'll pretty much kill the Ambassador Bridge, which...
I don't think so.
Well, relative to the money he's making now.
Maddie Maroon.
Mm.
Oh, everybody will really be crying if old Maddie Maroon makes less money.
Right.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I don't think that's
but
just
in
another.
General,
yeah,
do
go
you
ahead.
That'll help our economy.
I have no idea, actually, whether it will or will not. I mean, the whole idea that this bridge, a public facility, was sold off to a billionaire is just kind of so strange in the first place. But now I guess the Canadian government is going to pick up most of the tab for the new bridge and make it back in tolls. So that's good. All right. Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate it. Here.
Good question. If anyone knows where exactly it's going to be, I haven't looked into it that closely.
Me neither. Here's Brent and Taylor. Brent, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, well, I wanted to talk about gay marriage. You guys were talking about that. But as far as I know, that new bridge, they're saying it's going to be somewhere near the 75-94 interchange.
Sure,
on
that
our
would,
side.
That makes sense.
And it's go out on the 401 over in Canada. So,
yeah, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank
but,
you.
But no, I just wanted to make a comment that my dad fathered three sons, and he did leave my mother eventually because it turns out that he's homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been with the same guy for 15 or 16 years. So I don't understand where people come out saying it's destroying the sanctity of marriage because, I mean, just look at that. That's one prime example. I'm sure there's a million more out there.
And there are. I am familiar and acquainted with people who've been together for 30 years.
Yeah.
And they're of the same sex. And, you know, it's just another one of these stereotypes.
You know, Brent, one of the things I'm always struck by the images when finally gay people could get married in states like California and for a while in New York and Iowa, different, I think there's about, what, nine states or something like that, Massachusetts, and the joy on these people's faces that were finally able to say, hey, we
love each other.
Yeah, and Jalene is quoting these people. She's not talking about the two of us.
I love you,
we
Peter.
Love each, I love
yeah,
you, too.
Dearly.
But anyway. Where were we? Anyway,
not in a gay way.
Not in a gay way. Really? But anyway, where was he? People. Oh, yeah. So here, the joy is having public affirmation of their love for one another, that it's no longer.
And public, mostly meaning with the people they love, being in a public place and affirming it. Is that what you mean?
No,
or
I mean,
do you mean when they go.
I mean, before, you go to jail for doing this stuff.
Oh,
you know?
True.
Now,
true.
You know, they're saying, look, you are a full human being.
Yeah,
that,
you will not intimidate us.
You have equal rights under the law. In fact, it's possible that all these constitutional amendments that have been shamefully passed in states like Michigan forbidding marriage equality could be overturned as being contrary to, you know, equal rights under the law.
I mean,
equal protection under the law.
That just makes too much sense.
Yeah, right. But, you know, all of this is, people have made the point any number of times, that it's reminiscent of the civil rights movement and the idea that, you
the
know,
struggles.
That, yeah. Well, and also the fact that people could never really accept it. So now we got a situation where 2/3 of people under 40 think, they're like, yeah, well, I don't know. Who cares?
Like,
you know?
Be free.
Yeah. So,
not for me, but whatever.
What do you mean?
You know, well, no, I mean, people are saying it's not my cup of tea. That's not something I would choose to do. But at the same time, it doesn't affect me on a personal level. You know, just because there's two gentlemen together, two ladies together, doesn't mean that my kids are going to look at that and say, oh, I can't wait. My daughters are going to look at that and say, I can't wait to meet a nice lady that's going to treat me like this lady.
Right.
That lady.
They're going to follow their path because it is in your genes. I firmly believe that. You believe that, don't you?
And that is G-E-N-E-S.
In your genes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes. Your genealogical makeup.
I meant, you know, could have been G-E-A-N-S. Yeah, okay.
Or J-E-A-N-S?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what, to some extent, it's really no different than if your dad would have gotten divorced and married like a woman, right? I mean, it the family broke up. That's the sad part of it.
Yeah,
so, right.
But this is a little bit more of an unusual twist, even though we've gotten a little more sensible over the last few years. So how's everybody relate to all of that? I mean, in the family?
I mean, there's always going to be a low level of animosity because of how close my parents were when they were in high school and everything else.
Wow.
You know, and, you know, people feel like either side of the family feels like, oh, I can't believe that he did this to her. And at the same time, they're like, oh, I can't believe that she let him go.
Well, but, he followed his heart, right?
Exactly. He just wasn't comfortable where he was, you know.
Yeah.
And that's sad to say. Like you said, it did break up the family a little bit. But at the same time, it's like, you know, you can't live a lie. You're going to be miserable your entire life.
Yeah, you can't live your life out of fear of you know, I hate to say it, but hurting someone when you're hurting inside yourself.
Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, you want to always, it's not necessarily an accept, it becomes more than just wanting to be socially accepted. It's like, I'm not going to continue to pretend to be somebody that I'm not.
Yeah. Love me and like I am, and if you don't, see you later.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, thanks for the story, Brent. I appreciate
it. Thank you. That's a great story.
Have a great night, guys.
Yep, bye-bye. You too. I love that he shared it publicly and that we need more of that. And when it comes to little kids, he was talking about little kids seeing gay people, things like that. I think the biggest gift that you can give to your children is to teach them about diversity and show them that love is love, no matter what its form.
Sure. Yeah. It makes sense on the face of it. Here's a really despised minority making headlines, and that's atheists.
Oh, us?
10 years ago or so. Remember when we were doing a show, and there was a, I don't know if you remember, there was a study, and this was right after 9/11, and the majority respondents said that they would rather, which is, no matter how you cut this thing, it's terrible.
Yeah.
But they said they'd rather their child married a Muslim than an atheist. I mean, for one thing,
was a long time ago. That was so ridiculous.
It was also disparaging of Muslims. I mean, he was saying,
absolutely.
You know,
which goes on all the time.
Yeah.
People are never going to get over that in this country, Peter.
What, over 9/11?
No, they're not going to. The anti-Muslim sentiment that exists. No, I'm serious. There is always going to be, I think, bigger than you think, population of people who are anti-Muslim.
I think there is a large population. But, you know, one of the things that's happening, and we've talked about this, the way all immigrant groups begin to assimilate eventually. And they, you know, they become just mainstream Americans.
Yeah, well, it's too bad it takes so long.
You know, one thing.
And they have to have these struggles and...
One of the things that's, did you see that? The largest growing immigrant group in this country is not Hispanics, Asians.
Okay.
And Asians have a higher income, have the highest, as a group, have the highest income of any of the ethnic groups in this country, including whites.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. And did I say this last week? Henry Louis Gates, I think it was, said that if it wasn't for the importation of slavery into this country, there of course wouldn't be any racism. This would be a country filled solely of groups of Europeans
and American Indians on reservations.
Yeah, and it would be different white ethnic groups contending for relative power, privilege.
So disgusting.
Yeah, it is.
Ugh.
Why can't we all get along?
Which, Peter, this is why. You and I resigned from the white race. I mean, we did that probably 12 years ago.
We did.
You know, in the interest of humanity. That is the part we always have to tag on to the end there.
And there's no consequences.
No.
No. But anyway, it's a despised minority, atheists. The atheist family has lost its lawsuit to have Under God removed from the Pledge of Allegiance. In February, an atheist family in Massachusetts had been engaged in a legal battle to have Under God removed from the Pledge of Allegiance.
Kid was having to say it, right?
Yeah. The American Humanist Association announced that the Middlesex Superior Court had ruled against the family. According to the statement, the atheist parents are already planning an appeal. As the Blaze, what is the Blaze? Oh, it's a online thing. Previously reported, the family decided to sue the Acton-Boxborough school system, claiming that the recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance with the words "Under God" discriminates against their children.
It does.
Well, you know, you could. Couldn't you imagine people though saying, "Get over it. What's the deal?"
Well, I don't know. Yes, I can imagine people saying that, and I'm sure a lot of people have said that. But whatever happened to?
First Amendment.
First Amendment. What happened to inclusion?
Yeah.
And exclusion.
Right. Well, that's what it seems to me to violate the Establishment of Religion Clause, the first part of the First Amendment.
Yes.
Because if you go back and look when this was all done, as we've said any number of times, the Pledge of Allegiance was written in the 1890s by a Christian socialist minister, of which there was a lot of them back then. And, He had enough. He had enough grasp of the language that the words "under God"
were not in there.
It was added
in the 30s, right?
50s.
Or
50s. 50s, yeah.
Well, I always say the 30s, but the 50s.
But the point being, he being a Christian reverend, he could have put those words in there, but he didn't.
Sure. He didn't. He thought about it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. May have.
Or maybe he thought religion doesn't belong in it
First Amendment.
The First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States.
And you go back to the literature, you go back to the congressional hearings about putting Under God in there. I mean, first it was to distinguish us from the godless communists, right? And and I'm not even sure. One nation under God. What specifically does that mean? I'm not.
It's a good question.
I'm not sure in its precise meaning.
It's just not relevant.
I know. But in the congressional hearings, everybody who testified, including Reverend Billy Graham, talked about this being a Christian nation and that we had to put that in there to distinguish ourselves from the non-Christian nation. So it wasn't just a general thing about a supreme being that you could agree to if you were, you know, a Jew or a Muslim or something like that. Some other religion.
Like a higher power?
Yeah. You had to be a Christian in order to be down with this. So it obviously favors one religion over another.
Yep.
So it doesn't belong in there.
It does not.
Let's see. The family's lawyer, and how would you say his name? Niosi. David Niosi said, no child should go to school every day from kindergarten to grade school to be faced with an exercise that defines patriotism according to religious belief.
Yep. Agreed.
Agreed. Wait a minute. I want to keep talking about this, but I want to hear from Dave who wants to talk about the Windsor Bridge. Yeah, Dave, tell us. You're on the air. Tell us about the bridge.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Good. Love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been a listener for many years now.
Great.
I just got off work and I was just listening to the show, and you talk about the bridge. Just getting a little bit of insight on that. from Canada, they've expropriated a lot of property. It does lead from the 401. it will, like, just bypass, like, an ECO expressway. It's like an artery that from east to west to Windsor.
Right.
It'll go down towards the river. I think it's Del Rey.
Yeah.
It'll cross over there.
So it'll be in Detroit? Its terminus will be in Detroit?
Yeah, it'll be in that area downriver. Now, looking at the Ambassador Bridge the way it is now with Matty Maroon and, you know, with his fighting, you know, he's 80-something or 90-something years old. It just kind of strikes me kind of funny, an old man like
rich
that.
Rich old white man.
Last few years.
Worm.
And, you know, wouldn't you want to enjoy your life and, you know, with all the billions you have and, you know, instead of fighting for this bridge, which, you know, it's fine and all, but where the bridge right now, Ambassador Bridge, does empty out to, it's when you first get off the bridge and you go to its west end of Windsor,
yeah,
you have a railway crossing. It's the first thing you encounter when you get off the Ambassador Bridge, an active railway crossing. And then from there.
Okay, so you get stopped after being stopped.
Yeah. You're waiting in line at the Ambassador Bridge and Customs, and all of a sudden you have a train, mm-hmm. and you have a light right after that. You have 13 lights before you reach the 401 with the existing route it is now, from Ambassador Bridge to the 401.
Wow.
So,
which is the main highway running across Ontario to Toronto and points east, yeah.
Exactly. So you have all these red lights and you have these trucks idling and that. So with the new route, the way it is now, it's going to just 401 straight down to the river, cross that bridge, and you're going to exit or dump into I-75 or 94, what have you there. So I was just someone told me one time that if you go from Florida or Georgia and go all the way up 75 south or what have you, or the north going to Canada, you have 14 lights, and I think 13 are which are in Windsor.
Wow.
That's something else. Wow. Didn't know that.
All right, Dave, we got to end the show, so thanks for that.
I could listen to your Canadian accent all day.
Accent.
Sorry. it's late.
It is late. We're going home.
It's no accident. We're out of here.
Athena and Sarah for answering the phones.
Yes.
Putting together the podcast. That'll be ready in about 11 hours, and you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall.
And we'll be back next week.
I got more to say.
Oh, well, yeah. You're not done yet?
Or you can also, access it at WRIF.com. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com as well. Got a couple of very interesting interviews. First one about Facebook, and the second one, the incredible environmentalist Paul Ehrlich, talking about one of his latest books. So, next week.
We'll be back next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Tuesday, July 17th, the Riff returns to the links. It's the Riff's Rockin' Golf Outing at the Fountains Golf and Banquet Center in Clarkston. This is your big shot to spend the day on the course with everybody from the Riff, including breakfast, drinks, dinner, and, oh yeah, everyone who plays in the tournament will be off to rock out later that night with Nickelback, Bush, and My Darkest Day at TGE Energy Music Theater. Plus, My Darkest Day will be stopping by the golf course for a special acoustic performance.
This $100 reserves your spot in the outing along with your ticket to the show that night.
Spaces are first come, first serve.
The Riff's Rockin' Golf Outing, July 17th at the Fountains Golf and Banquet Center in Clarkston. Book your spot now at WRIF.com.
Ladies and gentlemen,
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
I give you
everything that rocks.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. A lot of people say to me, how come you're not on Facebook, Pete? Well, that's a long story, and this isn't about me. It's about me interviewing interesting guests, informative guests. And one is James P. Steyer. He's written a book called Talking Back to Facebook, The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. Now, I don't have any kids, but I read through this book, and this has a message for a lot of us. Jim Steyer is the founder and CEO of Common Sense Media, and he is, which is the nation's foremost nonpartisan organization dedicated to improving the media lives of kids and families. And he began his career as an elementary school teacher, went on to become a nationally respected child advocate, public interest lawyer, and Stanford professor. He lives with his wife and four children in the Bay Area, reaching them at his office in San Francisco. Jim Steyer, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Great to be here, Peter.
You're a busy man. I don't know how you do it. Four kids ought to be enough.
Well, that keeps you busy, that's for sure. And then in work, I delegate to all the my colleagues.
There you go. Well, Facebook. I was talking with someone a little while ago, and he talked about digital natives, younger people, not like you and me, who maybe even remember dial telephones, but rather kids that were brought up in the digital age, even have become young adults. It's a different world, isn't it?
It definitely is a different world, and I think for all the parents out there in your listening audience, Peter, I think it's very important that people understand that whether we're talking about Facebook or cell phones or Twitter or YouTube, this is having a profound impact on our kids and our teenagers. And how we approach this and how we have this conversation with our children, whether at home or in school or both, is going to be critical to their healthy development over the coming year. So these are incredibly important issues for every parent, every educator, and every young person out there to think about and learn from.
Now, how would you respond to this? When the telephone came out, when radio came out, when television came out, even when, you know, records came out in the 1920s, people said, oh, this is going to be the ruination of our young people. maybe with television it has, but there was always this concern, this fear of this new technology that mm-hmm. was about communicating, entertainment or information and what have you. So are we like overreacting?
I don't know if we're overreacting, but I also don't think it's ruination. But I will say this. I think the impact of some of the new media platforms is simply phenomenal. And I think that we underestimate it at our peril. I mean, Howard Gardner, who's a famed professor of education and child development at Harvard, probably the leading child development expert in the United States, has compared the changes in the digital media platforms to the invention of the printing press. So I don't think this is the same as just some other piece of technology. I believe it is changing the way that young people, and all of us in many cases, relate to each other. I think it's changing people's identities and how they express their identities and their personalities. I think it is having a profound impact on people's brains, particularly young people's brain development. And I think it is an addictive and compulsive platform at times, which can have big impact on our human lives and our families and friends. So those aren't minor issues, but I don't think it's ruination. I think the whole point is we have to have a common sense approach to these issues. We have to emphasize the positive benefits that we can get from these new platforms, and we have to limit the many downsides that Facebook, cell phones, and other devices can bring to our lives if used improperly.
Jim Steyer, in your book, Talking Back to Facebook, The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age, you use the phrase screen time. And that made me think. So I don't have any kids. I don't even have to worry about a lot of what you have in here. But it occurred to me just over the last 10 years how much screen time suddenly I'm faced with. Right now, there's four screens looking at me right now. I don't know if I'm looking at them. But tell us a little about that measurement of screen time.
Well, screen time talks, obviously, that includes television, and it includes the classic screens like movies. But it also today includes cell phones, iPads, and other tablets. and the many and video game machines and that and all those devices that our kids and many adults actually spend an awful lot of time in front of today. And, you know, we want the basic maxim in my book is that you have to have a balanced approach to screen time and you have to limit it. Now, if you're a parent of kids under the age of two, it's important that you know that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends zero screen time. Repeat, zero screen time for children under the age of two. Now, that's a pretty hard limit to keep to, particularly if you have four children like I do. But there's no question that we want to balance and moderate the amount of screen time that our kids are getting because it can impact their brains. And quite frankly, it can keep them away from a lot of other really important and healthy activities they should be doing, like playing outside, reading books, hanging out with friends and family, etc. You know, the Detroit area has beautiful places to go, and it's the summertime. People need to remember that they don't need to be glued to their cell phone or always tethered to their CrackBerry while they're out in nature and spending the summer with their friends and family. So screen time in moderate doses is a very healthy thing, particularly if you choose content wisely. But if you're constantly sitting in front of a screen, that raises concerns, particularly for children and teens.
One thing I realized that kids no longer know street games like Duck on a Rock or Red Rover or, I mean, even Red Rover, the simplest one of all. I wonder how many people even know what I'm talking about. So in many ways, life becomes defined externally.
That's exactly right. And I think it's very important that we remembered that we have a healthy balance on this. Look, Common Sense Media is very pro-media and technology. If you go to commonsense.org, we're the leading kids' media and technology organization in the United States by a long shot. You can go there. You can find the reviews of any movie, TV, video game, app, website, you name it. It's at commonsense.org. And we obviously help you get to the good stuff fast and help you avoid the bad stuff. But so we're not anti-media. And there's the second thing I would tell you is that the genie's out of the bottle when it comes to media and technology. We're not going to suddenly give up all of our cell phones, and every child in the world is not going to stop using the internet or social media. I mean, this stuff's here to stay. So the point is, how do we have a smart, balanced, healthy approach to this? How do we make it a positive in our lives? I mean, that's why I wrote Talking Back to Facebook. The second half of the book is Parenting 2.0 for the Digital Age. It's a common sense guide to raising kids in a world where cell phones and Facebook and Twitter and YouTube exist, and trying to give you some very practical tips and tools about how to deal with that. In many ways, you can start with your own behavior if you're a parent, because if you yourself are addicted to your BlackBerry or your cell phone and you're constantly compulsively checking it or bringing it to family meals or not paying attention to your children because you can't wait to see what the next email or text says, then you have some learning to do. And that's true for citizens and parents, teachers, young people all across the Detroit area. This is a very, very important issue. And in a sense, we all need to talk back to Facebook. We all need to be thinking much more intelligently about the proper use and abuse of our cell phones, because used wisely, they can be enhanced values to our lives. Used poorly, they can mess our kids up.
The website for the book is talkingbacktofacebook.com. There'll be a link on my website also to commonsense.org, James P. Steyer's group. He's the founder of it and also the CEO. And, you know, you mentioned something a little earlier, and that was about talking about no FaceTime for kids below two. I walked in a house, and there was this little baby, I mean, maybe like 6 or 7 months old, plunked in front of like Judge Judy or something. And I said to the woman, is she enjoying it? And she said, that's my babysitter. What are the consequences? You mentioned about brain development. What are the social and even physical consequences of that?
Well, I think, you know, the point is television has traditionally been an electronic babysitter. And today, if you will, iPads and iPhones and other forms of devices like that have become babysitters. And I'm the father of four kids, so I know how hard it is to raise kids. So I'm sympathetic to every parent out there in our listening audience, because it isn't that easy, and people do use the TV and other forms of media as a babysitter. But the point is a healthy balance, and not to just plunk your kid in front of some horrible show. So that's an amount of time issue. You know, it's okay to do it for a half an hour if you want to let them watch the Tigers game, for gosh sakes, but or even 2 hours if they're watching a Tigers game. But let's be honest, you don't want them to sit there for 5 or 6 hours a day in front of their video game machine, and you also want to make appropriate content choices, because there's a big difference between watching a Tigers game and watching some violent video game or some inappropriate movie with a lot of sexual or coarse content that the kid's not prepared for. So it's a matter of setting clear limits, setting clear time limits, but also being clear about what content is and is not appropriate for kids. Look, this is extra work for parents today, but it's part of parenting in the digital age, and everybody needs to use it. Again, that's why we built Common Sense Media, and that's why commonsense.org is such a great resource for people, because you can go there and sort of find out all the information, or you can find it on your cell phone, because there we have great apps that make it easy for you to make good choices too. But the bottom line for a parent is you have to be involved in your kids' consumption and use of media and technology today. It's part of their lives. It's part of all of our lives. How we do it, however, will have a big impact in terms of their future and how they learn and grow in a healthy way.
Tim Sawyer, your book, Talking Back to Facebook, has a foreword by Chelsea Clinton. How did that come about?
Well, Chelsea was first my student at Stanford University, where I've been a professor for more than 20 years. And then she was actually my teaching assistant. And she worked on my first book, The Other Parent, which is a very successful book that came out about 10 years ago and looked at the impact of media on the lives of our children. So Chelsea was my student, then my teaching assistant. And now she's a board member of Common Sense Media. I've known her family for a long time. And she's been very, very engaged in this from an academic and intellectual standpoint, and she's actually a terrific board member for Common Sense Media. And I think we would love, obviously, everybody in the listening audience to go out and buy Talking Back to Facebook, and I think you'll see that Chelsea's contribution is really well-written and very interesting. It talks a lot about how she grew up and how the limits that her parents put on her use of media, and also gives her perspective on key issues like privacy, which is obviously a huge issue for everybody today in a world where technology companies are violating our privacy left and right.
All of the advice that you suggested is excellent so far in broad terms, and I'd like to get into a little of the specifics of it. But if you crank back our time machine about 60 years, I'm sure that same good advice and accurate advice could have been given to parents who had just got a television in their house. But as you said, you used the phrase genies out of the bottle. There's so many genies that are out of the bottle, like, for instance, overt sexuality. I mean, in 1952, for instance, maybe you could wanted to stop the kid from looking at the Sears catalog for maiden form bras, but it took quite a bit of effort to find pornography. Now anybody over six could be looking at the, you know, the most explicit sexuality possible. How in the world? And here, Jim Steyer, this comes into you as a parent. I mean, how do you manage all this? Maybe if it's not too personal, just tell us a little about either general terms, or if you want to get into specific about how you deal in it with your family, how do you quote, maybe we need a better word, police?
I think the first thing, Peter, is you make it an ongoing topic of discussion and conversation. And obviously in the Steyer family, given the fact that I'm the, you know, the founder and the CEO of the biggest kids and media organization in the United States, my kids have had to live with this for quite some time, and they do consider me the world's most embarrassing dad, and wish that I had not started Common Sense Media. But alas for them, my long-suffering children have learned.
But well,
that
why?
This is
why
part of the reality?
Why are you?
I'm kidding. Well, because remember, Common Sense is in nearly 100 million homes in the United States, and so all of their kids, friends, parents, and families, and here in the Bay Area, use Common Sense either on the web or on their cell phones, and so they'll come home and go, "Dad, we were on a sleepover last night. We were going to be allowed to watch that movie, but then you said it wasn't okay," which is not necessarily true. And also, obviously, now with Common Sense is in over 30,000 schools in the United States, many in the Detroit area and the broader Michigan area, and so we have a digital literacy and digital citizenship curriculum, a K-12 curriculum in many, many schools around the country. It's actually in the schools that my kids attend. So they have to live with this stuff, whether they like it or not. But I think what we basically tried to do is set clear limits and also have a balanced approach. We do not believe in the abstinence model when it comes to media and technology. We believe in ongoing family discussion and dialogue, and we also believe that you can set clear limits and ask your kids to stick to them. And we do that. And I would tell you that for the most part, our kids are actually pretty smart consumers and users of media and technology. So our 14-year-old daughter, for example, does not have a Facebook page. Now, We talked a lot with her about that. I told her a lot about the impact of Facebook, for example, on kids' identity and particularly on the presentation anxiety that so many teenagers feel who are constantly reshuffling and even in many cases photoshopping their pictures on Facebook and constantly worrying about how the image will be presented to the world on Facebook or other social media platforms. So our daughter, who's 14, doesn't have a Facebook page and probably won't get one until she's about 15 or 16, which is actually the age I recommend in my book. So we've always talked with them about IMing, and I'm always able to tell them that, you know, too much time spent in front of a screen can be addictive, can affect their brains. We've talked a lot about too much, they don't get a TV set of their own in their own bedroom because we think that's a big mistake. They don't have violent video games because Common Sense Media is the organization in the country that led the fight against the sale of ultra-violent, sexually violent video games to minors. So my kids have grown up with this as a dinner table conversation, if you will. They know that we have rules around that. My wife enforces them with me, but we're fair. You know, we're Giants fans. We watch a lot of Giants games, Niner games. Our kids have watched TV. They played video games. The older two kids, who are one of whom's in college, one of whom is going to be a senior in high school, they have Facebook pages, but they use them wisely and appropriately. We don't give them a cell phone until they get to high school because we don't think kids need cell phones at age 8 or 9. And I think we've tried to have a healthy and balanced approach, but not one that preaches abstinence, if you will, and not one that is a series of ultimatums. But one way we've learned, by the way, to discipline our children is if they violate the rules, we take away the device, whether it's their phone or their video game machine.
Don't you get
and that works? That works with kids. Let me tell you.
Don't you get though, Dad? Everybody, you know.
We do. In fact, we've always said that we should have a little section of the Common Sense Media website that was called You're the Only Parent Who. So that all the parents out there could go and – because that's kids' classic line. I'm the only kid who doesn't have a cell phone. I'm the only kid who isn't allowed to have a Facebook page. That's actually not correct in most cases, but it's certainly a good conversation to have with your kids. By the way, one of the great things about media and technology is it forces you to have conversation with your children about issues like sex and violence and commercialism. They're really important parts of their growing up. So you can really use – media and technology for teachable moments. And I think that's an incredibly important part of my book and about what Common Sense Media is all about in the first place, is media and technology are here to stay. How you use them in your family and as a parent and as an educator is critical to the healthy development of our kids. So you have to be first and foremost a role model, and you have to set clear limits for kids. Kids need boundaries, they need clear limits, and they need guidance. I mean, essentially, that is the role of parenting, particularly as children get older and become teenagers. They really are working with your values and your judgment because they're making more and more of their own independent decisions. So start early, set limits, set good role models for kids. You know, remember location, location, location in terms of where you put devices and TV sets in your house. And also make sure that you unplug. You have to take personal technology timeouts and spend unplugged time with your kids and create, you know, no media zones like meal time. This is just part of the reality of parenting in the digital age. And every parent in the Detroit area and across the country needs to use a little common sense when it comes to this crucial aspect of our children's development.
And James P. Steyer is the founder of Common Sense Media. You can go to commonsense.org and find just incredible resources. The book is Talking Back to Facebook. Just add .com to that, and you have the specific website for that. The subtitle is The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. We just have a couple of minutes left with Jim Steyer. And you talk, though, that Facebook is targeting kids under 13, whereas you think they shouldn't even really be on it till they're about 16.
Definitely.
What's an issue here?
Well, I think the biggest issue is the way human beings and young people communicate with each other. Look, I don't want a 5 or 6 year old on Facebook. I don't want them having 1,000 friends when they can barely even tell the difference between, you know, 1, 2, and 3. So I think one of the things we have to think about is how much do we want these platforms to invade our kids' lives? Also, in the case of Facebook, the platform itself raises enormous privacy concerns that everybody out there needs to be aware of, because there are benefits to Facebook, but there are enormous concerns if the platform's used unwisely, and the privacy is a huge issue. First, kids oftentimes self-reveal before they self-reflect. They post things or hit the send button before they think. So that can be an enormous issue. And in a world where there's no eraser button, and right now there is no eraser button, kids can suffer major long-term consequences for posting that stupid drunken picture or the semi-naked photo or being tagged in photos on Facebook. So there can be real consequences to that. The second aspect of the self-reveal before you self-reflect stuff is cyberbullying and other forms of antisocial behavior that occur in the oftentimes impersonal, anonymous world of the Internet. The other, you also have the enormous presentation anxiety and the social-emotional issues that many teens face when they're constantly being presenting themselves and being scrutinized in that world. You know, Facebook stalking is a very, very common practice among teens and kids in the Detroit area. That just means they're always checking each other out and, you know, stalking people on those platforms. You know, that can be a very big issue. The second piece of this is the privacy issues that relate to the fact that your personal information is now used and tracked by millions of bots and websites that you don't know what's happening. So privacy is a fundamental right in the United States, and kids and adults need to be aware of that. And right now there are no really clear common sense privacy laws, and the tech companies have pretty much tried to set it up so that they can use your information whenever they want in whatever they way, unless you read that 80-page privacy policy on your cell phone and don't agree with it. So we need some balance and some common sense when it comes to privacy laws in the United States, and we need to rein in some of the mistakes that young people and even adults will make when they self-reveal before they self-reflect. This is a very important conversation for everybody in our listening audience to have with themselves and most of all with their children.
Tim Steyer, your group, Common Sense, at commonsense.org, just does incredible work, and it's a great resource for individuals, for parents, for everybody that's interested in the content of media and how it impacts our life. All of a sudden, I had the feeling, though, of you being sort of the Dutch boy with their finger in the dike, that the media, we're so mediatized that it's overwhelming. I think about people that I'm talking to them. They're just getting text after text, and I go, hey, and they go, I'm listening, as they're...
But they're not. But
no,
they're not.
Well, you're right. But so the point being, can we get to a sensible point, or are we just going to, the flood water is going to come through the dike?
Well, I think we can. And the point of the writing Talking Back to Facebook was to start a very important national conversation, because I think this happens so quickly. And I don't think I'm the little Dutch boy with my finger in the dike. I think what okay. I am, you know, Ed Markey in the one of the blurbs of the book said I was Paul Revere. I don't know if I would agree with that one either.
Well, that's better. That's better than being the little Dutch boy.
I think
agree.
What we're trying to do is say, look, let's stop and have a conversation here right now as parents, as educators, as citizens about the pros and cons of all this. See, so much of this happened so quickly, and it was driven by engineers and technology who are solely focused on data acquisition and aggregation. And the point is, as society, there are big social and emotional implications of all these devices. So we have to talk about it. You're example with your friend where they're constantly glued to their CrackBerry or cell phone instead of paying attention to you is a very big deal. But the only way that's going to change is through conversation and education. And I think that Talking Back to Facebook, which has been an enormous success as a book, and you can get it anywhere now, is it's been a very good conversation starter. And obviously, Common Sense is a very large organization. We put these issues out in the Detroit area and all across the United States, in Washington, in front of the politicians, in schools, all, in every state in the nation. And the point is, we need to take stock of all this and emphasize all the good things we can get from media and technology and limit the bad things. That's not putting your finger in the dike. That's starting a very important national conversation that will carry on for the next few years. And I believe we as a society will come up with smart, common sense rules of the road so that we can make these things positive aspects of our lives and limit some of the social and emotional consequences for children.
I like the sound of that a lot better than my little analogy. My guest has been James P. Steyer. That's S-T-E-Y-E-R. And the book is Talking Back to Facebook. It's published by Scribner. And the subtitle, very important, The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. Go to commonsense.org. And I didn't know about the teaching, the curriculum part of it. So
yeah,
teachers in the
over 30,000 schools in the United States.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's great. The book itself, talkingbacktofacebook.com, there'll be links to all of it on my site, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Jim Steyer, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
Great to be here, Peter, and good luck to everybody in the Detroit area. Great to talk to you guys.
This is Night Call.
on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com.
Hey, it's Drew from Drew and Mike, and so your retirement account took a hit. Or maybe your unemployment benefits expired. Who knows and who cares what causes you to need extra money? All you know is you need cash and you need it fast. Well, what do you have lying around that you can take to your neighborhood checking gold? Classic coins, you know, pre-64 U.S. coins are 90% silver. A pre-64 quarter is worth over $5. A half dollar is worth over 12. Sterling silver flatware sets, those are raking in around $2,500. Spare yourself the embarrassment of borrowing from friends or family. Check and Gold pays you 20 to 30% more because they've removed the middleman from the equation. So what do you have? Gold, silver, diamonds, coins? Just cash them in at one of Check and Gold's 11 suburban Detroit locations. Just look around. There's probably one right over your shoulder. Over 1,000 Metro Detroiters every month go to Check and Gold when they need cash. Call them at 800-574-GOLD. That's 800-574-GOLD. Or visit online at checkandgold.com. That's check, the letter N, gold.com.
Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. The Philip K. Dick novel, science fiction writer, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? It had a movie version, Blade Runner. And you may remember, replicants, they couldn't tell if they were human or not, except they gave them this test called the empathy test. And it was Dick's contention that what it made us human was our capacity for empathy with other people. If you didn't have it, you were some sort of replicant, an android. An incredible book has come my way, challenging to how we think of the world, ourselves, our communities. It's called Humanity on a Tightrope: Thoughts on Empathy, Family, and Big Changes for a Viable Future. It's co-authored by Paul Ehrlich and Dr. Robert Evans Ornstein. We're going to be talking with Paul Ehrlich, and I'm sure many of you know his name from the famous book he wrote over 40 years ago, The Population Bomb. But it also, among his other 40 books, Human Natures and the Dominant Animal, It treats the seriousness of how we are confronting the environment and each other, and also always the possibility, of global collapse of civilization. But I think that's what's meant by humanity on a tightrope. And Dr. Ehrlich is a Bing Professor of Population Studies, President of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University. We're reaching him at his office. Paul Ehrlich, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
It's nice to be here.
Yeah, empathy. Does that kind of encompass what humanity on a tightrope is all about?
Yeah, it's a major thing because we use the tightrope analogy just because if you've ever watched somebody trying to cross a chasm on a tightrope, you can find yourself when he starts or she starts leaning too far to the right, you sort of lean to the left to try and bring it back. We have, as you just indicated, unlike virtually any other animals, to a small degree, presumably, say chimpanzees, bonobos, they certainly can understand that other animals have minds of their own and different thoughts, but basically human beings are the ones who can really put themselves in the shoes of other people, and we have special neurons that help us to do that, that help us to understand what other people are feeling and make that is being empathetic. And of course, if you understand what somebody's feeling when they're in misery, you can be sympathetic as well.
Throughout your writing history and the books you've published, Paul Ehrlich, people have said you're a Cassandra, you're a Chicken Little. Is the sky really falling now? I get that feeling.
Let's put it this way. The only debate, and I spend a lot of time on this with my colleagues, among my colleagues in environmental science and related disciplines, is simply what is required for us to do if we are going to avoid a collapse of civilization. You know, we've had lots of collapses of civilizations in the past, from Easter Island to the civilizations of the Tigris and Euphrates valleys and Yucatan and so on. But this is the first time we're faced with a collapse of a global civilization, and that would be very, very bad. Possibly for many people listening to this, but certainly for their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And I have a great-grandchild that I care a lot about, and I would like to see her get a decent world.
You would think that just utilizing that phrase, the collapse of civilization, would scare the bejesus out of everyone. I suspect, given what we're bombarded with all the time, that it hopefully probably only piques people's interest and doesn't really frighten them. I mean, go ahead.
We're doing more work in how culture evolves and how people behave. And unfortunately, one of the main results of social science, and we're working very hard to bring more social scientists into the battle to save civilization, one of the real results is to show that simply having information does not necessarily lead people to take action for a lot of different reasons. I mean, one of the tragic examples of this is that during the Second World War, Jewish people in Germany and the rest of Europe got more and more information about the intention of the Nazis to exterminate them, and yet they, in most cases, found it extremely difficult to take any action. And this is sort of like the situation now. You have a scientific consensus, a very solid one, as good as you ever get, basically, that we're disrupting the climate, and that could cause massive, massive problems, including huge amounts of starvation and so on. And yet a few well-paid deniers and the fact that you really have to change your behavior to do something about this has prevented us from doing anything. I mean, we're coming up on 20 years of solid failure in trying to globally get together and do something significant about climate disruption.
It all doesn't sound very encouraging.
You can look at it two ways. If we had 1,000 years, I'd be very encouraged because human beings have been spreading empathy. You know, we're originally a small group animal. In many ways, we still are, culturally and genetically. We're programmed to relate well to people whose faces we recognize or we see all the time. And by the way, anybody can see that tendency in us. You know, if you watch a soap opera like, say, one of the TV shows like Law and Order, or if you read a good novel and you have a favorite character and something happens bad to that character or they die, you get depressed even though you know perfectly well the character doesn't exist. It is totally fictional. You can't avoid actually relating to other people. And that's a very big positive because we have learned to relate, for example, in the United States to other Americans. We relate to them even though we don't know them personally. We've learned to do that. The big step we've got to make is one very parallel to the one that 13 states made in North America a couple hundred years ago. And that was, you know, if you've read the Federalist Papers or the Anti-Federalist Papers, there was huge discussions of how the states could get together and form a nation without losing some of their small group characteristics. We now have to look at how nations can get together and form a global regime of some sort to solve our global problems without losing some of our local things. And this makes it especially difficult for a small group animal when we are wildly overpopulated. We're at 7 billion people. We have 309 million Americans, which is almost triple the number that we need that anybody's ever given a good reason for having alive at one time. It's a gigantic problem, which we are slowly solving, but unfortunately too slowly because the other things, the toxification of the planet, climate disruption, the chances of a nuclear war that could end the whole thing, the epidemiological environment getting shakier and shakier, all of those things mean we've got to move much faster than the general course of cultural evolution, which has brought us as far as we've come.
Well, Paul Ehrlich, almost every phrase there is worthy of a conversation. Paul Ehrlich, along with Dr. Robert Evan Ornstein, has written a new book, Thoughts on Empathy, Family, and Big Changes for a Viable Future. The main title is Humanity on a Tightrope. If you'd like to go and search this out, particularly buy it on Amazon, you can go to Paul Ehrlich. The last name is spelled E-H-R-L-I-C-H. You can go to Paul Ehrlich Tightrope, and you'll get it. Or you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and there'll be a direct link to it. Let's stick on empathy for a while, because, as you know, in groups, usually pre-technological groups, their names usually mean the people, and everybody else outside of there are something less than the people. And that also is something that often dominates our country as well. You know, we're number one. We're the best country in the world. And I always ask people, what's number two? You know, who's at our heels?
But it's a very good point, because making a group of us always to some degree implies a group of them. But when there were maybe 500,000 people on the planet, they were all hunters and gatherers. Everybody in your hunter-gatherer group was closely genetically related to you, and even the neighboring groups were genetically related to you. You looked alike, you behaved alike, and if you got in each other's hair, you could just move further away. And, what we've done now is created a situation in which that no longer applies. We have to deal with people of all kinds and so on. We've done an amazing job of accomplishing that, but of course we've paid huge prices, and some of those prices are millions of people dead in religious wars or other wars, and the racism, which is from a biological point of view, ridiculous, but from a social point of view, very important. And we have learned to be empathetic much more broadly than we used to be. For example, when we invaded Iraq to get the oil, which was insane. In other words, it was like if we were hungry invading Iraq to get their cyanide. But nonetheless, when we did it, even those of us who were totally opposed to it were happy to see Saddam Hussein disappear because we didn't like the way he was treating his people. 200 years ago, nobody gave a damn in the United States what happened to people in Iraq or vice versa. And, gradually, there are lots of people in our country who care about the entire world. We all get our empathy turned on when we see and our sympathy when we see what happens in places like Uganda or in Haiti recently and so on. So we've learned to be more empathetic, but not far enough and fast enough, and in particular, not to care enough for future generations. We care about our kids, we care about our grandkids, but if we don't have that sort of face-to-face contact with people, once you get past grandchildren, what did posterity ever do for me? And that's a huge change that we've got to make. We've got to care about what happens to our grandchildren's great-grandchildren.
Well, Alec, you have a co-author for your book, Humanity on a Tightrope, your colleague at Stanford University, Robert Evan Ornstein. Why is he on board, or did he bring you on board?
Well, I like working with Bob is Bob is a brilliant psychologist, and a huge amount of our problems are fundamentally psychological. We've got to understand how we change people's minds and how they get changed in a direction which is good for them. And Bob just happens to be a genius in this area, and he's a wonderful co-author.
Tell us what he brings to the book, though, specifically.
Well, he brings to the book, for example, a lot of the stories of how people have actually discovered how you can get race out of an issue or put it into an issue, or how children, for example, is a wonderful picture of a baby imitating an adult's facial expressions. We have the built-in capacity to relate to other people, and a beautiful example is that a baby can imitate your expression, that they understand that you're making it, somehow they neurally understand, even at a very young age, that a smile means something and you can return it. The book is larded with great stuff from Bob, and one of the advantages you have being in a position like I am at the world's greatest university is that there are lots and lots of things I don't know anything about, but there are lots and lots of colleagues who know a lot, and I try and take advantage of that. And individuals, when you look at all the problems of the world, and you say to yourself, how can I understand this? How can I do anything about it? Well, one of the things you can do is organize your friends and become a little more specialized so that you're the person who tries to figure out exactly what's going on with the climate, and one of your friends starts reading some of the articles on how even a small nuclear war between India and Pakistan could ruin us. And another one of your friends asks the question, well, why aren't we doing more about setting up possible quarantine systems and so on if we get another bad epidemic? In other words, you can divide up and become more specialized and have people that you trust that can give you the score on an issue, because it is daunting. I mean, I spend, probably 12 hours a day, 7 days a week dealing with these issues, and it's hard to keep up. And so I feel very sympathetic for people who care about their society but feel sort of helpless about what to do.
Well, Paul Ehrlich, you just did an us and them. You said Stanford was the greatest university.
Pay me to say that?
Do you think that us, University of Michigan, Michigan State folks? I mean, actually, I was...
By the way, I attended a graduation at Michigan State a couple of years ago. I was enormously impressed by the president, a wonderful lady, and the fact of the number of people they're educating, which is far beyond what Stanford manages to do.
I was curious. I mean, I wasn't just joking, because when someone said name the best universities in the United States, they'd probably mostly go for the, the Eastern Ivy League colleges, maybe colleges like the University of Michigan.
I don't think it's a terribly useful exercise in the following sense. I think that a student I think we have a big problem with how we educate elementary through high school, but a student who wants an education and a good education can get one at almost any state or private school in the United States. In other words, they all have good libraries, they all have good teachers, they have some lousy teachers too, but a good student will find out about the teachers and it's a two-way street. For example, at Stanford, many undergraduates are afraid to approach the faculty on things. The faculty are usually delighted to bring undergraduates into their research operations. And for instance, one of the very best of my colleagues now, one of arguably the most distinguished environmental scientists under the age of 60 in the world, Gretchen Daly, started in our research group as an undergraduate. People can get a good education in this country. Unfortunately, we're not putting enough effort or money into our elementary through high school, and we do need to reorganize our education above that. In other words, the basic structure of most of our universities traces to Aristotle and has a group of disciplines that no longer make any sense. And gradually, again, that's changing. We're getting more interdisciplinary, and so on. But again, it's like other things. We move a little too slowly.
This is maybe a smaller issue, but why there's not hundreds of thousands of students and their parents out in the streets demanding free university education as we do K through high school, and taking that money from the $1 trillion war budget is way beyond me.
I think it's the not only the responsibility of our society to see that everybody gets educated, but it's a survival must. In other words, one of the biggest problems we have is that, for example, people, every person in the United States ought to understand what the evidence is that climate change is being driven by human activities. It's very simple, but again, it just isn't transmitted to everybody, and it should be. Everybody should have a right to education. It's like, you know, I want to pay taxes in order to educate other people's children. I don't have any children to educate anymore. My daughter has a PhD. But I would want to pay those taxes because I want my grandchildren to live in a better society. And one of the worst ideas we've come up with recently is that taxes are somehow a burden imposed on us by the government. Taxes are what you pay for the services that only the government can really reasonably supply, like our national defense, like education for everybody, like decent health care. The idea of having insurance companies whose sole goal is to make money and have you die as fast as possible if you get sick, control our health system, is just plain nuts.
It's
but
crazy.
People are not well educated enough to see through those silly arguments.
Paul Ehrlich is my guest. He's co-authored Humanity on a Tightrope, Thoughts on Empathy, Family, and Big Changes for a Stable Future. If you go to his name, Paul, and it's Paul R. period, Ehrlich, Ehrlich, Tightrope, and Google it. You'll get right to it. Also, my website, peterwerby.com, will have a link as well. Paul Ehrlich, you have authored over 40 books, and probably the most famous one was The Population Bomb. And if someone would have said, what field is Paul Ehrlich in, I would have said, his training is in ecology and in demography. And yet I was just looking up a biography for you, and your specialty was butterflies. Is there?
Oh, yeah. Of course, I was in basically a biology department and used butterflies as a tool for asking questions in ecology and evolution.
So that's what I was asking. Yeah, I mean, so that's not something you've left way behind. This informs your thought.
Oh, yeah, I still work with butterflies because they turn out to have wonderful advantages as experimental animals outside the lab, the same way fruit flies and gut bacteria have inside the lab. Because you can write numbers on them, follow them around, you don't have to worry about abusing them, the butterflies have, and they're beautiful. Yeah, when I've worked underwater, I've worked on butterfly fishes. Why not work on something beautiful if you have a chance?
There you go. Hey, you know, your book, The Population Bomb, a lot of places where you look, it has the adjective controversial before it. And I remember when it came out and thinking and reading some of the debates, and they said that Paul Ehrlich, he just doesn't want the colored masses expanding. I mean, you were accused of every crime in the
book. Am if you go on the web.
Okay.
I've written numerous papers and a whole book on why racism is nonsensical. But, one of the things about our new media situation is anybody can become a media expert and put out a blog.
Well, I was going to say, but how long ago was it written? 40 years?
1968, 42 years.
42 years ago. And how many people were on the planet then? About
3.5 billion. And people complained bitterly when I said that the battle to feed all of humanity is over. That was in 3.5 billion people then and about 500 million hungry. Today, we have 7 billion people and about 1 billion hungry. And yet, even to this day, you can find bloggers saying, well, Ehrlich was wrong. We've lost several hundred million people to starvation since the book was written. That's sad because we didn't have to. I mean, we could easily, even today, feed everybody, but it would require something that's a no-no. That's redistribution. Now, redistribution is a no-no in the view of the people who control the world, although they have been redistributing wealth from the poor to the rich hand over fist, particularly in the United States recently.
But I was going to say,
it's got to turn it around.
As long as the redistribution is going upwards. I try to tell people, there's always distribution and redistribution. If I want a dollar an hour more from my employer, that's a redistribution of wealth. He or they or it has less, I have more. I mean,
absolutely right.
Yeah.
One ought to understand that better. But again, it's the kind of thing we don't cover well in our education system. Just like we don't train people all the way up through college to deal with the medical system or the legal system, unless you're actually going to medical school or law school. And what puzzles most people, including me, more than anything else, how do you deal with financial issues, and how do you deal with legal issues? And that's what, something that should, like, just like environmental education, ought to start in kindergarten, with not saying see spot run, say see the plant grow in the sun, so you make the connection to photosynthesis. We need to revise our education system, and everybody ought to get involved in it.
Well, you've described in Humanity on a Tightrope, which means we fall the wrong way, or we fall either way, we're facing perhaps a collapse of civilization, as you and your co-author, Robert Ornstein, talk about. We've just got a couple minutes left. What do we need to be doing? Is it just reading Humanity on a Tightrope, or do we need policy decisions or United Nations? What do we have a chance?
What we need to do is build a larger issue public around the whole issue of how we get ourselves organized and how we change our cultural evolution. There's a movement starting called the Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior, the MAHB, M-A-H-B, which is trying to get social scientists together with natural scientists and everybody, and all of them together with representatives of decision makers and the general public to ask questions like, what do we want out of life? How many people do we want to have on the planet versus how do we want to live? Because, of course, if we live like Beverly Hills millionaires, we can have fewer people sustainably on the planet than if we live like middle-class Mexicans. And these issues need to be discussed. The ethical issues are not discussed. For example, if you have a church group, ask them to start looking into the issue of what do we owe to our grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and what do we owe to people in sub-Saharan Africa, and how do you decide who owes what to whom? In other words, we're social animals. Join an environmental group or organize one in your church and focus on the environmental ethics issues, which are gigantic everywhere. You know, is it ethical for us to burn what oil there is on the planet, or should we save a lot of it for future generations, maybe when they have a carbon capture technology or can use it for, making plastics, so on. There's all kinds of ways you can get involved. And, of course, maybe the most important is learning about this stuff and voting. Nothing congressmen hate worse than going back to their previous careers of being crooked used car salesmen or crooked lawyers.
You know, the thing that frightens me is that fear negates empathy. And we're in a period now where the idea that we're going to get lots of people thinking even about their neighbor who may be facing foreclosure when they fear the same thing is that fear can often have the whip hand.
Absolutely. But, you know, huge numbers of Americans are now out of work. Huge numbers of Americans are losing their homes. And those huge number of Americans ought to start talking with each other and everybody else and thinking about what mistake we've made in how we designed the country. I mean, why do we have people are becoming billionaires on Wall Street when they're parasites on society? They do almost nothing of any use even when they're not crooks. And yet we have a huge amount of the money in our country is poured into the pockets of Wall Street thugs. You know, why do we do that? Why do we permit it? Well, it's something to ask our politicians. Why are they the ones having wrecked the economy who are now benefiting? And, if you don't get out and become active in what's wrong with the system, then you're going to suffer from the mistakes of the system. You got to change it.
I want to thank you so much. Paul Ehrlich has been my guest. He and Robert Ornstein are the co-authors of Humanity on a Tightrope. And if you put Paul Ehrlich, and that's E-H-R-L-I-C-H, in Tightrope, you'll get links to it. Also on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Bill McGibbon, who is the author of Earth Making Life on a Tough New Planet, says Ehrlich and Ornstein, not for the first time, have cut to the heart of the problem we face and do not for a minute think it can't be done. It's incredible. Thank you, Paul Ehrlich.
Great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
Hey, it's Drew from Drew and Mike, and whether it's a car repair, a medical bill, a home repair, all you need is one of these to send your finances into a tailspin you don't need. Before you scramble for cash, relax, focus, take a look around your home,
What do you have lying around that you can take to your neighborhood checking gold? A 14-karat chain-link bracelet? Remember that? No, that's because you haven't worn it since 1987. Take it to Checkin' Gold. It's probably worth about $700 to $800, maybe even more. What about a sterling silver flatware set? Those have been pulling in around $2,500. Checkin' Gold doesn't pay a middleman, and because of that, you get 20 to 30% more cash on the spot. What you got? Gold, silver, diamonds, coins? It's time to cash them in. With 11 suburban Detroit locations, chances are you'll find a Checkin' Gold if you just look around you right now. See why over 1,000 Metro Detroiters every month go to Checkin' Gold when they need cash. Visit online at checkingold.com or call them at 800-574-GOLD. That's 800-574-GOLD.
Good news, guys. Hey, it's Susie Cole from The Riff, giving you the heads up that WRF.com and Pepsi are keeping your finger on the pulse of the music world. I'm talking about my Riff Rock Report online at WRF.com. Check it out to find out what's happening in the world of rock, including my blog to get the scoop.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
Fun new.
Oh, look, here's some breaking news.
Back to the Rock on the Riff.